In a new series, I'm exploring one of the biggest shifts in how we understand human difference.
The label is not the important part.
All Kinds of Minds begins next Monday morning at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 19th of August. Good morning. This is Today with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb.
Good to be back with you. Good morning. The headlines. Ukraine's ousted defence minister has hit out at corruption and demanded a wartime election, challenging the authority of President Zelensky. A drive to offer every rough sleeper in England a bed this winter has been announced by Andy Burnham. The Housing Secretary, Angela Rayner, will be joining us after 8 o'clock.
And also in today's programme, the UN's head of humanitarian affairs is in Ukraine to draw the world's attention to the civilian cost of drone warfare.
I think the technology, I'm afraid, is outpacing accountability, and the technology is outpacing humanity.
Applications for degree apprenticeships are soaring as students look for alternatives to university debt, but many are finding it hard to find spaces.
I was logging how much time I was spending throughout the kind of 7-8 months that I was doing this application process, and I think it was just under about 500 hours.
And good morning from Mike Williams, live at Headingley, where a new era for English cricket begins today. Well, a new era of sorts. Joe Root returns for his second spell as England captain for the first test with Pakistan, replacing Ben Stokes. We will hear from Root later in the programme.
The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Ukraine's former defence minister Mykhailo Fedorov, whose sacking last month prompted mass protests, has called for wartime elections in an apparent challenge to President Zelensky. In a video posted online, Mr. Fedorov said Ukraine was facing a crisis of governance and corruption. He's the first senior Ukrainian politician to demand new elections, which are prohibited during wartime. Jacob Evans has this report.
Mykhailo Fedorov was a highly popular defence minister, credited with driving innovation in the Ukrainian army, especially in the use of drones. In July, his surprise dismissal by President Zelensky led to protests and repeated calls for his reinstatement. That's not happened, and now Mr. Fedorov has lashed out, saying democracy is not a peacetime luxury. Hours earlier, Mr. Zelensky formally nominated the acting defence minister, Yevhen Khamara, to take up the post in a permanent capacity. Under Ukrainian law, elections cannot be held during wartime. It's meant Volodymyr Zelensky has stayed in office 2 years longer than his term was originally supposed to last.
The Prime Minister has vowed that every rough sleeper in England will be offered accommodation this winter. Andy Burnham made ending rough sleeping his first pledge on entering Downing Street and says he now wants to get everyone in for Christmas. Our social affairs correspondent Michael Buchanan reports.
Official data suggests almost 4,800 people slept rough in England on a single night last autumn, nearly double the figure recorded in 2021, when a programme to protect rough sleepers from COVID-19 saw significant reductions. Andy Burnham hopes to build on that scheme and has pledged £442 million to tackle the problem. Councils and mayors will be asked to find solutions, such as sourcing temporary accommodation, and the money will go towards identifying more than 1,000 houses for rough sleepers. Charities welcomed the initiative. The Conservatives said there was no delivery plan.
The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, has said Britain should join the EU's new Migration and Asylum Pact as a way to tackle small boat crossings across the Channel. The agreement, which came into force in June, aims to speed up the asylum process and increase the number of irregular migrants returned to their home countries. Labour said the government's efforts to work with European countries to tackle small boat crossings were bearing fruit. Police in West Sussex say three members of the same family died after getting into difficulty in the sea off Shoreham yesterday. They're believed to be a couple and their teenage daughter. A fourth member of the family, a younger girl, was rescued but is critically ill. Our reporter Sam Harrison is in Shoreham.
Emergency services were called to Shoreham just before 3 o'clock in the afternoon, following reports that four people had got into difficulty in the water. What followed was a very large emergency response, involving a lifeboat, Coast Guard helicopters and two air ambulances. Four people were brought to shore, but it was later confirmed that a man, a woman and a teenage girl, all from the same family, had died. A younger girl is in a critical condition in hospital. Anyone with information or footage of the incident is being asked to contact Sussex Police.
President Trump has paused a planned rollout of a new 50% tariffs on some Canadian goods, saying a deal had been reached and the measures would be paused for 3 days, subject to documents being finalised. The announcement came after Mr. Trump held talks with Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney hours before the planned duties were due to take effect. Mr. Carney said there was still important work to be done. The BBC has found that competition for degree apprenticeships advertised on the government's platform in England has quadrupled in the past 3 years. The popularity of degree apprenticeships, which offer a paid-for university degree and a salary, has grown as the cost of university has come under increased scrutiny. More from our education correspondent Hazel Shearing.
There are more than 11 applications for every degree apprenticeship on the government's Find an Apprenticeship service in England. The data is an indication of soaring demand, with the number of applicants more than doubling and the number of positions almost halving in the past 3 years. Concerns about the cost of university has prompted more students to live at home, and there are calls to reform student loan repayments. The Department for Work and Pensions says it's backing employers who take on young apprentices.
An Australian woman who killed three relatives by feeding them a meal laced with poisonous mushrooms has begun an appeal against her murder conviction. Erin Patterson's lawyers say she didn't receive a fair trial last year. The hearing in Melbourne will also include an appeal from prosecutors who say Patterson's life sentence was too lenient because it allows for the possibility of parole. The Queen has described the pressure of keeping the King's cancer diagnosis secret in the early stages of his treatment. Camilla was speaking in a video released by Buckingham Palace to mark the 30th anniversary of the cancer charity Maggie's, of which she is the president. The Queen talks about officially opening the charity's support centre in London in January 2024, before news of her husband's cancer was made public.
That was quite difficult. I almost said something, but you know, I felt that it wasn't the time to say. Looked at everybody who was suffering and all the relations, and I think it made me realise even more how important these places were. I was just longing to let it out, but obviously I couldn't.
The Harland and Wolff shipyard in Belfast is to spend £3 million refurbishing its famous yellow cranes, known as Samson and Goliath. The gantry cranes, which have become symbols of the city, will be used as the yard builds three Royal Navy support ships. Samson and Goliath are both capable of lifting 840 tonnes, equivalent to four Boeing 747 jumbo jets.
Thanks very much, Jane. It is 7 minutes past six. Shall we get our first look at the weather forecast? Helen Willits is at the BBC Weather Centre. I know you're not meant to do this on national radio, but I did get some rain on my head this morning. Should we be excited?
Well, I'm excited, Emma. And I hope you are as well. I got some rain as well this morning driving in. Not enough, but the forecast for the rest of the week is a little bit more unsettled. The problem we have is it's going to be showery a lot of the time, so we can't guarantee significant amounts of rain for everywhere that needs the rain, but there will be some significant rain around. Let's start that detail with England and Wales, where overnight Wisley also had some rain, ending the 62-day dry spell. Now, that rain that you talked about, Emma, is a weather front sitting in the south of England at the moment and across the Channel Islands. So heavy rain to come for the Channel Islands. The rain still flirting with the south coast of England should clear by the time we get to late morning. Elsewhere across England and Wales, sunny spells and a scattering of showers. But this afternoon, there could be some quite potent showers across northern England, perhaps North Wales, the North Midlands, Lincolnshire, East Anglia, even the odd rumble of thunder. So that will yield quite a significant amount of rainfall, but they'll be hit and miss. And in between, some sunshine and temperatures 20 to 25 degrees Celsius. So not as warm as it was yesterday, coming back down to average for August. For Northern Ireland, I think we'll see lot of showers, quite slow moving showers as well. The winds are lighter here for a time, so there'll be hail and thunder too, temperatures of 16 to 19. And for Scotland as well, a weather front in the north and quite breezy here with a northeasterly breeze, so 12 or 13 for the Northern Isles. Elsewhere, the showers just becoming more frequent as the day goes on, heavy and prolonged with hail and with thunder and gusty winds near the showers, temperatures around 19 at best.
Helen, thank you for that. 9 minutes past six is the time. Let's have our first go at the papers. Andy Burnham telling the Times that economic growth is now the responsibility of Number 10 North as part of a power shift away from Whitehall. In an interview, the Prime Minister says that Treasury's role of controlling the public finances sometimes clouds that growth mission. The Times describes Mr. Burnham likening Number 10 North to Harold Wilson's Department of Economic Affairs, a dedicated ministry for growth. It was launched back in 1964 and reincorporated into the Treasury 3 years later.
The Prime Minister marks his rough sleeping pledge with articles published in The Guardian and The Daily Mirror. In the former, Mr. Burnham says he's never accepted homelessness as a fact of life, a philosophy which he argues took hold in Westminster in the 1980s. In The Mirror, he highlights the national response to homelessness during the pandemic, with everyone all in it together. The iPaper says the vow to bring people off the streets by Christmas is a major test for the Prime Minister, as it cautions that not all councils may welcome being asked to work towards this goal.
Tragedy at the seaside is the headline in the Daily Mail as it leads on the deaths of three members of the same family at Shoreham-by-Sea. Citing a witness, the paper says two adults jumped into the water to help the children, one of whom was later pulled from the sea by a fisherman who then raised the alarm.
The Financial Times leads on long-term borrowing costs reaching multi-decade highs yesterday in the US, Europe and Japan. The bond market is said to be nervous because of fiscal deficits with no obvious levers for improvement in countries where growth is subpar and inflation sticky.
Several papers highlight Queen Camilla's comments about having to keep the King's cancer a secret. She's pictured on the front page of The Express, The Mirror. The Telegraph says that with unprecedented candour, the Queen has revealed her husband's determination to keep working after he was first diagnosed. The Sun's leader column praises the couple for showing unyielding courage in a way they face cancer with dignity and with honesty.
It's 11 minutes past six.
Let's turn to that tragedy in Shoreham-by-Sea. Three people from the same family drowning off the coast of Shoreham. Sam Harrison is our correspondent who is there. Tell us, Sam, what the police are telling us about what they know happened.
Good morning. Well, it is a rather grey and drab day here on the southeast coast, which I think reflects the awful mood. We're told that shortly before 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon, emergency services were called out to the water close to Shoreham Port, where there were reports of four people getting into difficulty out there. And what followed was an enormous emergency response. Several helicopters were used along the seafront. There were a string of emergency vehicles, including many ambulances, trying to continue the operation as it came towards shore. Now, late last night, we did receive that really shocking and tragic news, actually, that three out of the four people have died in connection to this. They are a man, a woman, and a teenage girl, all believed to be from the same family. And we are told that a younger girl has survived this. She was pulled out of the water alive. She is in a critical condition in hospital. And now many thoughts of people here and across the country will be with her. This is yet another really tragic, tragic accident involving the sea on the southeast coast. And people here this morning feeling very, very low.
Sam Harrison in Shoreham. Thank you.
It's 13 minutes past six. President Trump's campaign against the International Criminal Court has stepped up another notch with new sanctions against the court's president and senior trial lawyer. The ICC has international jurisdiction to prosecute genocide and crimes against humanity with more than 120 members, not including America or Israel. Tom Bateman is our State Department correspondent, and he's been telling me why President Trump's administration is in dispute with the court in the first place.
President Trump's disdain for the court dates back to his first term. Notably, one of the things that happened then was the start of an investigation by the court into Afghanistan. Now, that covered the Taliban, the Afghan National Forces, but also the role of the United States in Afghanistan, which caused a furore among US officials. And that really sort of carried across both Republican and Democrat administrations. But it has been the Trump administrations that have targeted the court with these punitive measures. But the Trump administration has put the court in its sights ever since really the start of this term. There was an executive order from February last year saying that for its actions against both the US and Israel, the Trump administration was going to go after it, basically, and that it has done. with sanctions. Those have covered now up some 11 officials, including judges and prosecutors. And now we have these top two officials, the president of the court, Temoko Akanye, and the senior trial lawyer, a man called Abdoulaye Sey. And this, again, is sanctions. I mean, basically, these are financial punishments that make life pretty difficult for these individuals.
The court has more than 120 members, not the US or Israel. What will happen now? I mean, what will the impact be of this? On the individuals, it's very restrictive, as you mentioned, the financial restrictions. But does it impact its ability to do its work? I'm just thinking of our listeners will also remember the court being in the news last month because members of the ICC voted to dismiss its chief prosecutor, Karim Khan, for alleged sexual misconduct, which he's denied. But what's the impact on the court?
Well, I mean, the sanctions have really been sort of chipping away at the individuals, and largely they have, you know, decided to live with that. And, you know, they've talked about this being an attempt to coerce the court and the judges. And Marco Rubio has said he wants to dismantle the International Criminal Court brick by brick. Now, it is my sense that what has in part happened here is the State Department has basically been pressurizing the Japanese government to withdraw from the court. I assume the answer to that was no, as it will have been so far from European countries. And hence, in retaliation to that, you've now got sanctions against the Japanese president of the court itself. So it's these escalatory measures that the State Department is dishing out to try to really pull the rug from the entire basis of the institution itself.
Tom Bateman, our State Department correspondent, thank you. 16 minutes past six, borrowing costs for governments around the world have risen to new highs, increasing pressure on those in charge of the nation's finances. Sean Farrington is back with some more on this. Good morning, Sean.
Hi, Emma. Yes, we have that budget in a few months' time, don't we, towards the end of October. So our own Chancellor here will be watching with great interest about the cost of UK government borrowing. It's been one of those areas around the world that has seen an increase in those interest rates on longer-term borrowing in recent days. This time yesterday morning, we were talking about the 19-year highs for US government borrowing. Over the course of yesterday, we saw borrowing costs in France get to their highest level since the financial crisis, in Germany for 15 years. And the 30-year UK gilt, so that's effectively the UK government borrowing money over a 30-year period. The interest rate on that moved within a whisker of a record set a few months ago. I've got Ella Good with me, who's head of fixed income at Newton Investments. Ella, good morning.
Good morning, Sean.
What's happened in recent days that has meant we're hitting these highs again? What nervousness is there out there?
Well, broadly speaking, around the inflation math, particularly with the higher energy costs that we face and sort of less room for central banks to ease monetary policy. I mean, we've seen that with the Bank of England, for example. Earlier this year, we were looking for cuts and now basically unchanged or even potentially a hike is sort of being baked in by markets. So there's that element. And then there's fiscal concerns. So bond investors are concerned about the amount of debt that governments need to roll over around the world. So it's not just a UK phenomenon. And broadly speaking, also, central banks were very active in owning government debt, say, over the last 10, 15 years. And so they are now exiting those bond markets. So, for example, Bank of England has been reducing its gilt holdings over the last 4 or 5 years. And so as a result, there's less demand for those bonds. So those are the three key metrics I would flag.
Can we zoom in a bit on the UK economy and the consequences of these higher borrowing levels for the Chancellor, who is going to be trying to attempt to stay within those fiscal rules, those borrowing rules that effectively he's now setting himself these days? If these interest rates are where they are, what does that mean for the number crunching that he will have to do?
Yes, I mean, just a reminder that on the fiscal rules, basically not to spend more than we're earning in income. So a little bit like your budget at home, I suppose. But look, I mean, we had about 22 billion worth of headroom in the November 25, so OBR assessment and the budget, I guess. And so this move higher in yields erodes a lot of that fiscal headroom, if you like. So roughly, you know, around the tune of about 8 to 10 billion. And of course, we have the additional defense element that we have to add to that. And so you have less fiscal room as you go into the autumn budget to basically play with, I guess. And so that's the immediate repercussion for the government. For consumers, it's obviously the direct effect in your mortgage borrowing rate, right? So over the course of this year, your mortgage rate would have gone up quite a bit, I would say. So about 0.7 to 0.8%, if you like, on your typical 2 to 5 year mortgage.
And have those questions about, you know, the amount of room the Chancellor will have come October for his spending plans. So have those questions that have been brought about because of higher interest rates, because of increased, you know, promises on defence spending, are they in themselves starting to get those bond investors, those around the world who, you know, effectively set the rate at which the government borrows in these senses? Is it starting to make them more nervous, the financial situation in the UK, and in itself putting interest rates even higher?
I mean, I want to highlight that it's a global phenomenon, right? So it is a concern in the US, it's a concern in Japan. You mentioned France as well just earlier. So it's not a UK-specific phenomenon, but for sure our long-end, for example, maturities, like your 30-year maturities, is certainly one of the highest in G7. So we are definitely front and center. And one of the reasons is because a third of our debt is owned by foreigners. And so obviously they are very price-sensitive and fiscal math-sensitive. So certainly, as that fiscal room erodes, concerns can go up. But I want to highlight it's not just a UK-specific phenomenon.
Ella Good, thank you for your time this morning. Head of Fixed Income at Newton Investments. I've got Russ Mould, Investment Director at AJ Bell, here with me in the studio. Russ, good morning.
Good morning to you, Sean.
Alongside, you know, the conversations that the Chancellor will be looking at over the next couple of months will be where can growth in the economy come from. What do you make of the story on the front of the Times this morning, which sort of adds to this, the number 10 north that Andy Burnham has in mind about, you know, where the balance of power lies, about who's driving policy towards growth around the country. So growth coming out of number 10 north, the policies for it, and the Treasury keeping more of an eye on the public finances.
I mean, growth in every postcode is the Prime Minister's mission. That will help the nation's finances no end and get those bond yields down if it achieves it, because it means taxation income goes up and support and welfare payments go down. We have been here before. I think another Labour Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, tried it with the Department of Economic Affairs in the 1960s, and that didn't last terribly long. I think it lasted just his first term. So it's not a new idea, but it's an understandable one. I think the end for any Prime Ministership, a healthy relationship with the Chancellor of the Exchequer is absolutely fundamental. And the Treasury itself, its room for manoeuvre isn't as great as it used to be. The Office for Budget Responsibility from 2010, the Bank of England calling interest rates since 1997. So the Treasury doesn't have as much room for manoeuvre as perhaps the Prime Minister may think anyway.
Ask you about what goings on at Fraser's Group, Mike Ashley's Fraser's Group, as you would often term it. It's increased its stake in Hugo Boss to just under 50%. So trying to get the company to accept its takeover offer, that was rejected by a few investors. So where's Mike Ashley go next?
Well, Hugo Boss's management have said they look forward to working with a major shareholder and a major vendor of their goods through Mike Ashley's stores. And in the end, Mr. Ashley's strategy, or in his son-in-law Michael Murray's strategy, remains the same. Get luxury brands into the flannel shops, get them into the department stores, maybe, and then drive those sales of those products up the luxury chain and help the profits and the sales of the business, and maybe get some of those suppliers to accept their buy now, pay later services as well. So it's trying to cement those relationships and probably give the Ashley empire, Fraser's, a bit more leverage in those relationships.
And in the drink sector, Diageo and the boss there, relatively new boss, Dave Lewis.
Yes.
Giving a bit more detail on what has been going on there, shedding 2,000 of its workforce. Is that what investors want to see happening at Diageo?
It sounds awful. I mean, they are looking for a turnaround in that business. Its share price peaked at £40 when we were all incarcerated at home during lockdowns, and there was a lot of talk of alcohol consumption going up, premiumisation of products. Diageo is now changing its strategy because Gen Z may be drinking less. An Ozempic generation where people maybe want to drink less because they're taking weight loss drugs. And again, the premiumization strategy, there's a cost of living crisis going on. So Diageo is changing its strategy, now looking more at canned cocktails and pre-packed drinks, and getting its cost base down, and the share price is just starting to respond to this new strategy under Sir Dev.
Russ Mould, AJ from AJ Bell, thank you for your time this morning. Let's have a little look at what's going on at Nike. The share price of Nike, sports goods company, of course, hit its lowest level since 2014 this week. Its market value, so how much it's worth on the stock market, it's worth less than a quarter of what it was 5 years ago. A few of its rivals have been struggling as well. Under Armour and Adidas have seen big falls. Is this something Nike specific, the scale of that fall, or more broad? Massimo Giunco is a brand consultant who worked for Nike for 25 years, ultimately ran the brand strategy for all of the company stores in Europe, Middle East and Africa. Massimo, good morning to you. How's Nike got here?
Good morning, and thank you for the question. It's a quite interesting business case. I mean, the origin of the problems of Nike probably came 5 years ago with the decision of the CEO of the time, John Donahoe, to change quite heavily the strategy of the company, you know. From a distribution perspective, focusing more on direct-to-consumer. From a product perspective, focusing on gender instead of specific sports. And from a marketing perspective, going from brand inspiration to transaction and digital marketing to support the traffic to Nike.com.
Yeah, and so that was a bit of their aim. So what hasn't been working for some of these major brands? What are shoppers doing that, you know, the likes of Nike don't want them to be doing?
The shopper didn't change a lot in terms of attitude and behavior. They couldn't find, in the case of Nike or in the case of many other major brands, they couldn't find the product that they wanted in the usual stores where they're buying. And that's why they probably shifted to other brands like Salomon, Asics, Saucony.
Yeah. So has that been a trend? The second you sort of move away from your traditional way of buying something, you go online and you're introduced to newer brands. Is the brand loyalty in sporting goods just not what it used to be?
I would say that there is a certain decline in the appetite for sneakers overall. And it's more driven by occasional buyers and that are maybe more loyal to the store and their retail brand,
right,
instead of loyal to the brand.
Massimo, so, we're going to have to wrap it up there, but thank you for your time this morning. Massimo Giunco there, who was at Nike for 25 years. I'll be back after 7 o'clock, keeping a very close eye on the latest inflation numbers. How much have prices been rising? Big week for economic data.
Sean, thank you for that. And you've had to wrap it up because at 27 minutes past 6, we need to go to Headingley and to Mike.
Yes, thank you, Justin. Morning has broken here at Headingley and a new dawn awaits for English cricket too today. We are here for the first day of the first test against Pakistan. The first match since Ben Stokes retired, not only as England captain, but from test cricket altogether. In his absence, England have turned to their most experienced player to lead the team. Their highest ever run scorer, Joe Root, returns to captain the side for a second time, having stood down as skipper in 2022 after a five-year stint. The 35-year-old returns as part of a new look England side for this three-match series. There is a new head coach on the way too. The New Zealander Stephen Fleming has replaced Brendan McCullum as test coach, although he is not in post for this series. Marcus Trescothick instead takes temporary charge, with Fleming starting his new role for the tour of South Africa in December. But it is all change for England, and ahead of this first match back as captain, I've been speaking to Joe Root and I asked him how big of an absence Ben Stokes will be for his side.
It does change the balance to things to a degree. You lose your captain, a batter and a bowler all in one. But it gives an opportunity for us to look at something slightly different, to reshape the team. It might not be how we've traditionally structured things for a long period of time, with Ben being ever present for the best part of 15 years. But, you know, I don't think that necessarily has to be to our detriment in some ways. It can be an opportunity for us to look at the game slightly differently and find a way of getting more out of players in slightly different roles.
Well, it is a little damp here in Leeds this morning. Small bit of overnight rain, although thankfully clear at the moment as the sun starts to peek through away to my left here at Headingley. Forecast looking pretty fair, perhaps a bit of rain this afternoon. But if you're coming down here for the first day of the first test against Pakistan, we should thankfully see plenty of play. We will hear more from Joe Root later in the programme. Elsewhere, away from cricket, just to tell you, big football transfer went through last night. Manchester City confirming the £65 million sale of their Spanish World Cup winner Rodri to Barcelona. The 2024 Ballon d'Or winner has signed a four-year contract at the Nou Camp. In rugby league, Warrington Wolves beat the defending champions Hull KR last night to close the gap on the Super League's top two. And to mark your card as well later, there's a special programme on 5 Live this evening, marking 10 years to the day since the greatest moment in the history of British hockey, when GB's women dramatically won gold in a penalty shootout at the 2016 Rio Olympics. Kate and Helen Richardson-Walsh, who were both on the team that day, are on the programme, alongside Sophie Duchess of Edinburgh, who is a patron of English hockey and a huge fan of the sport. You can hear that programme from 9 p.m. on BBC Sounds. And finally, I can leave you with a late summer treat. The racing tips are back, and they come at York today, which hosts the first day of the Ebor Festival, one of British racing's richest prize pots, available later. Here are the selections then. At 1:50, we go with number 18, Air Force One. And then at 3:35, our selection number 9, Item.
Mike, in Headingley, possibly not with the sunshine he was looking forward to. Thank you. At 6:30, I can tell you a new series of The Reunion is starting on Radio 4 this weekend.
Explore moments of modern history with me, Kirsty Wark.
All I could think of is that I hadn't been sacked, so I must be doing something all right.
Meet the people who brought Casualty to our screens 40 years ago. Revisit two landmark Scottish films from the 1980s.
I'm so jealous I wasn't in Local Hero.
And first, relive the Isle of Wight Festival, one of the biggest music events of the 20th century.
Well, it looked like a medieval encampment on the eve of a great battle, and it was incredibly spectacular.
That's The Reunion on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starting on Sunday morning at 10.
29 minutes to 7 is the time. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett, Justin Webb and Jane Steele with the news.
Ukraine's former defence minister Mykhailo Fedorov has become the country's first senior political figure to call for wartime elections to be held. His dismissal by President Zelensky last month sparked mass protests across Ukraine. In a post on YouTube, he said democracy couldn't be held hostage by Russia. The Prime Minister, Andy Burnham, has pledged to offer every rough sleeper in England a route off the streets this winter. More than £440 million of government funding will go towards helping councils and mayors find temporary accommodation and support for rough sleepers. The Conservatives have welcomed the initiative, but criticised what they said was the lack of a delivery plan. Police in West Sussex say three members of the same family have died after getting into difficulty in the water off Shoreham-by-Sea yesterday. Officers said a man, a woman and a teenage girl had died, and a younger girl from the same family was in a critical condition in hospital. The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, is urging the UK to join the EU's Migration and Asylum Pact, arguing this could give the government the power to return migrants crossing on small boats to the first EU country they entered. Joining the scheme could cost around £100 million a year, which the Lib Dems argue is a fraction of the current costs. Labour says it has worked more closely with the bloc since it came to power. President Trump says he has suspended 50% tariffs on some Canadian goods, which were due to come into force today, for 3 days. He said a deal had been reached with Canada, subject to documents being finalised. The Canadian Prime Minister, Mark Carney, said there was still important work to be done. The Queen has spoken candidly about having to keep the King's cancer diagnosis secret in the early stages of his treatment. In a video released by Buckingham Palace to mark the 30th anniversary of the cancer charity Maggie's, she also recalls her husband's determination to keep working even after he was diagnosed.
Thank you for that. 27 minutes to 7 is the time. As we were hearing in the news there, there's been a political bombshell in Ukraine overnight, a call for a wartime election from the defence minister who was recently sacked by President Zelensky. Let's talk to Dan Johnson, our correspondent, who's in Kiev. What is he asking for exactly, Dan, and why?
Good morning. He is insisting, urging, calling for elections, but not just elections. He wants those elections to bring about significant change at the top of Ukrainian government and a cleanup of corruption. He says that the military is being hampered by the lack of supplies and equipment, that corruption is denying them. He said that trust between citizen and state needed to be rebuilt and hope needed to be restored for the people. He doesn't name President Volodymyr Zelensky in this, but I think this is a direct challenge, a gauntlet that is put down to President Zelensky to either hold those elections and stand or get out of the way and let new leadership take over. And the former defense secretary, if President Zelensky thought removing him from his job was going to stop him being a problem or a challenge, he is finding out that Mykhailo Fedorov, it would seem, has high ambitions and is determined to see change happen, whether he is the vehicle for that or not.
Is it likely now that Zelensky has to change his mind? Because he said in the past, doesn't he? He doesn't want to hold elections at the moment. Is this a significant enough challenge that it changes things?
Elections are more than 2 years overdue now, and the president has relied on the constitutional position, the law here, that says while ever martial law is in place, there cannot be free and fair, effective elections. And that had largely been accepted during the first few years of this war. But there have been growing questions about the way Zelensky has made decisions about appointments and tactics, not just in sacking the defense minister, which he then had to go back over with sacking the head of the armed forces as well, but also in his relationships with important figures like Donald Trump, who has accused him of not respecting democracy for the fact that he's not held elections. There have been weekly protests in Kyiv since the defense minister was sacked. So it looks like he's seen that body of support, thinks that he has found a moment here where he believes things have reached a position that they just have to change, and is laying down that challenge to the president. The practicalities are difficult to understand, and we haven't had that detail from him about how these elections, when these elections would take place, how they would be guaranteed to be free and fair. But certainly he has made the strongest and clearest statement we've had from anybody senior in Ukrainian politics, that effectively President Zelensky's time is up, perhaps, or at least he needs to restate his mandate. When I spoke to Mykhailo Fedorov a week ago off the record, he actually told me that he thought these elections should be held and that he thought President Zelensky may well win. He didn't say that he would definitely be a challenger, but I think the fact that this has been laid down so clearly would suggest he is going to play a role when and if those elections come.
Dan Johnson in Kyiv, thank you.
24 minutes to seven. Do you remember the first pledge of the new Prime Minister? To end rough sleeping. Now Andy Burnham is putting more money behind the plan and wants to, quote, get everyone in for Christmas. What does that mean? How much will it cost? Michael Buchanan is the BBC Social Affairs correspondent. Michael, tell us a bit more about what's been announced. Good morning.
Good morning indeed. Yes, well, what Andy Burnham has announced is another £102 million on top of the £340 million he committed to tackling rough sleeping on the very first day he entered Downing Street. So that's £442 million in total, which the government say is fully funded from existing Ministry of Housing budgets. And what they're saying that will be used for is to offer every rough sleeper in England accommodation this winter. That will be done principally through councils and mayors, who will be tasked with coming up with the solution for their own local area, but they'll be expected to find emergency accommodation, whether that's in bed and breakfast accommodation, hostels, night shelters, whatever it takes effectively to make that offer. And there will be some of the funding will also be used to ensure that some of these rough sleepers who are then taken off the streets can be moved into more permanent accommodation over the coming months and years.
I mean, there has been, of course, a lot of analysis, and we're going to have a bit more on the programme, of the pledge he made, the same pledge he made in Manchester as mayor of Greater Manchester. And while numbers went down, they have gone up in recent years of rough sleepers. So what is to be said about the detail or the difference here?
Well, I think the starting point is that the official data shows there were just under 4,800 people rough sleeping on a single night in England in 2025. Now, there's criticism of that official data because it seemed to be undercounting the problem because of the rules around the data collection. So that's the benchmark from which Andy Burnham and this pledge will be measured. He wants to take inspiration from a scheme called Everyone In, which existed during the pandemic and which substantially did reduce the number of rough sweepers at that time when they were protected from COVID-19. But one of the key things that was done then that is not an option now is that hotels were used because no visitors were staying in the hotels. So governments and councils used them. And the key challenge for this pledge will be to find the accommodation. The Prime Minister says that the areas with the biggest need will get the most money, which obviously makes logical sense. But the difficulty that a lot of those areas have at the moment is that even for those people, homeless people, that they have a legal duty to help, so for instance families with children, they are finding it extremely difficult to find any type of accommodation, which is why they sometimes have to move people dozens or a couple of hundred miles away from where the local council is actually situated. So the extent to which these councils and mayors, even with this level of funding, will be able to physically find the housing to put these people into is going to be the biggest challenge, given that the Prime Minister himself has said he wants all this to be done by Christmas.
Michael Buchanan, we'll be speaking to Angela Rayner, the Housing Secretary, after 8 o'clock.
20 to 7 is the time. Now, a California court has heard claims that Meta deliberately designed its platforms to be addictive to young people. It was on day one of a trial that represents the biggest legal challenge that the social media behemoth has ever faced. Let's talk to Lily Jamali, our North America technology correspondent, who is monitoring this trial. Give us a sense, Lily, of the first day.
The first day, the courtroom was full. I mean, we were sitting shoulder to shoulder in there for one thing. And what we heard today were opening statements, starting with the states, followed by Meta. The trial was kicked off by California Deputy Attorney General Megan O'Neill, who accused Meta of hiding the truth about the potential harms of their platforms to young users, those platforms being Instagram and Facebook. She tried to draw a contrast between what people like Mark Zuckerberg, the head of Meta, have said publicly about how safe their platforms are and what they saw internally in the way of research, surveys that they took from young people that made clear that a significant proportion of people of a certain age, some between 13 and 15, were experiencing pretty awful things on their platforms, bullying, violence, seeing nudity, for example. Meta, when it was their turn, painted a very different picture. They painted Meta as a transparent company that has spun these challenges and that research that I just mentioned into tools to make their platform safer. They also tried to soften what is going to be some controversial or potentially prickly language that we see in internal emails among Meta employees. So sort of preempting what jurors are going to see in the coming weeks.
So what actually happens in the coming weeks? They've both set out their initial stalls, as it were. You hear presumably now from witnesses, and then you say there's a jury. So what are we expecting? When are we expecting the actual decision to be made?
That's right. They're going to hear about 6 weeks of testimony. Some of that has already begun. So towards the end of today, we heard from a company whistleblower named Arturo Bejar, who was at Facebook, left and came back because of what he witnessed in his own family, how his kids were interacting with Instagram. He said he wanted to go back and make change. And he said he flagged concerns to the very highest levels of the company, but was ignored. We're going to hear more from him and people like him. We may hear from Mark Zuckerberg. I pressed the California Attorney General today to find out whether Mark Zuckerberg will in fact testify. He was evasive, but it does look pretty likely. And this case, even though there is a jury, will ultimately be decided by a judge. The jury, if they come to a verdict, that verdict will be advisory only. And so this judge, Yvonne Gonzalez-Rogers, who has dealt with a number of very technical, in some cases, tech lawsuits, will be the final decision maker with respect to what happens, and what she decides could impact billions of users around the world.
Lily Jamali, our North America technology correspondent. Thank you.
It's 17 minutes to 7. Just looking through some of the morning papers and the headlines today. The Times has an interview with Andy Burnham, and in it he uses it to talk in more detail about the shift of power
to number 10 North. Namely, it will take over responsibility for economic growth from the Treasury, a huge transfer of power away from Whitehall. That's how the Prime Minister puts it. He's hit back at critics who've derided number 10 North as a satellite office. He said the department's focus on balancing the books. Sometimes this is the Treasury clouds that growth mission, and that the significance of number 10 North, which is now going to have that mission firmly in its sights, according to him, which is based in Manchester, would become more and more apparent as we go forward. And just on a lighter note, if you'll indulge me, Charles Darwin apparently was right about something else. Tickling. More than 150 years after he proposed that the parts of the body touched least often were the most likely to make us squirm and laugh, researchers have put the idea to the test with some good results and positive correlation. Apparently, why we are ticklish has confounded great thinkers for centuries. Researchers looking at this said the study could still not tell us what evolutionary function tickling serves. It remains an open question. There you go. I didn't know it confounded us, but apparently it has.
6:45 is the time.
Now, at 6:45, to turn our attention to that supposed ceasefire 10 months after it supposedly came into effect in Gaza, President Trump's peace plan for the Strip has stalled. More than 1,200 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli strikes since the ceasefire was announced last October, bringing the total number killed during the war to more than 73,000. That's according to the Hamas-run health ministry in the Strip. But there are fears that the actual number of deaths could be significantly higher. The Red Cross say there are more than 5,000 Palestinians still missing in Gaza. Israel does not allow journalists free access to the territory still. Our correspondent John Donison has this report from Jerusalem.
In Gaza City earlier this month, a mass funeral for more than 100 people killed in an Israeli attack in 2023. Their bodies were only recently recovered from under the rubble. And across the Strip, there remain thousands who are still missing. Ahmed Al-Madhoun was 21 when he was last seen alive. The young man, who has Down syndrome, disappeared in May 2025 after popping to the shop. His family show us a video of him belly-flopping into a swimming pool. They say he was loved by everyone and always joking around. For his mother, Majdia, it's the not knowing that's hardest.
I haven't lost hope. Whether I find him alive, find him dead, find him buried, if they just tell me here he is, then I will truly be at peace.
She knows Ahmed may well be dead, but there's also another reason why Gazans go missing. Aida Al-Drimli shows us a picture of her son, Mahmoud, a fresh-faced young man draped in a Palestinian scarf. He too disappeared in 2024. Aida feared he'd been killed. But then this summer, a photo emerged on social media showing two Israeli soldiers posing with a Palestinian detainee, blindfolded and bound. The family believes it's Mahmoud.
My heart was torn into two when I saw the photo. I was relieved that my son was okay. But at the same time, how can they humiliate him and other prisoners like him?
We asked the Israeli prison service about Mahmoud. They said they had no record of holding him. The Israeli military declined to comment. Well, here in Jerusalem, I've come now to meet Tal Steiner, an Israeli lawyer who's the executive director of Hamoked, a human rights organisation that works to trace missing Gazans who may be being held in Israeli jails.
What is the impact on the families of these people in terms of not knowing?
The impact on families of the enforcedly disappeared people is devastating. It's an open wound that doesn't heal. They have no rest, not even in knowing if their relative is dead or alive to bring him to proper burial.
Amid the destruction, The Red Cross estimates there are more than 5,000 missing people in Gaza. For their families, displaced and homeless, they're still not able to grieve.
That was John Donison reporting. It's 12 minutes to 7. Now, in terms of what's going on around rough sleeping and what Andy Burnham wants to do about it, he's put more detail out there today in terms of those aspirations. Where better to look than his record on rough sleeping and his recent record in Manchester, a place he tried and ultimately failed to do the same. He did reduce the numbers, but now they're rising again in recent years. What are the learnings? Mr. Burnham now has the keys to the most powerful office in the land then. Well, Amanda Croom is the head of homelessness at the charity Caritas based in Salford. She's seen many policy approaches to rough sleeping, including those used by the Prime Minister during his time as Mayor of Greater Manchester.
I've worked in homelessness for over 35 years in Greater Manchester, and I've seen different initiatives come and go, and I've seen the numbers of people on the streets going up and down over the years. But at the moment, I feel really hopeful because this is the first time we've got a Prime Minister who really understands homelessness and has worked in it and has been able to make a real impact. Nobody wants to sleep on the street. No one chooses to sleep on the street. If people are given the right alternative offer, then they will come off the street. Sometimes that offer needs to be somewhere where they feel safe, somewhere where they feel secure. And so for some people, that needs to be their own independent tenancies with support. For other people, it may be in a supported hostel environment. And there needs to be a variety of different things because everyone's needs are different.
Listening to that, Yoshi Herman, the founder of The Mill, a local news publication in Manchester. Yoshi, does he know what he's talking about when it comes to homelessness?
Well, I suppose he knows more than most politicians, because when he became mayor of Greater Manchester in 2017, his big pledge was that he was going to end rough sleeping in Manchester. And so he has invested more time in this issue and more kind of political capital in this issue than anyone else. And I can see why on his first day as Prime Minister, you know, he would want to recommit to this mission, which is almost maybe an admission to say, well, I wasn't able to fix it in Manchester, but now I'm Prime Minister, I've got all the levers, etc. So I think he does know more than others. I think that's perhaps separate from the question of whether he will be able to end rough sleeping.
Will he?
I don't think so. Certainly not with the kind of amounts of money that have been announced today. I mean, I've been reading the proposal that his government put out last night, sort of, you know, 400 million or something. I think it's about 100 million more than was announced in July. None of that money seems to be new money committed from the Treasury. It all seems to be within the existing housing department's budgets. Tens of millions have been spent in Greater Manchester. And as we've reported on The Mill, the numbers came down. And now they've gone up for 4 years in a row. Every year, Andy Burnham's administration put out a press release announcing how many rough sleepers there were. This year, we noticed that they hadn't. First time that we hadn't received a press release. So we asked them for the number, and the number confirmed that we are basically back in the same range as we were when Andy Burnham became mayor. And when I walk around in the city centre of Manchester, when I go to the office, you know, you encounter people sleeping on the streets all the time.
What do you think went wrong then?
I think it got huge political attention for a few years. I remember his chief of staff, Andy Burnham's chief of staff, was getting up at 4 a.m, walking around the streets, taking the names of people on the streets. It was a huge mayoral priority. And I think what's happened in the past few years, it's been a little bit less of a focus. And, you know, early on, I think what Andy Burnham was really good at is he was kind of getting everyone in the room, like getting the health people and the social care people and the police in the room and kind of banging heads together to make change. And I think, you know, the focus has maybe shifted.
But does that mean your focus can shift, but if you set up a good system, it should still have an impact? Did he not set up sustainable systems, or what was wrong with what, for instance, you know, having a bed every night, that scheme?
A bed every night was a scheme that was pretty good at the front end, i.e. just getting people off the streets as quickly as possible. It was much less impressive on the back end. What do you then do with those people? Because we don't have a surplus of social housing to put them into. There are thousands of people just in Greater Manchester who are warehoused in pretty appalling conditions in temporary accommodation, which is what homeless people get if they can't get social housing. And so it kind of solved the kind of immediate problem, and people might say the most serious problem of people being on the streets, but it didn't lead anywhere particularly effectively. And I think you'll probably see the same issues with the national scheme, particularly because they don't seem to be putting much money into it.
Yoshi Herman will be talking to the Housing Secretary after 8 o'clock, but good to talk to you. That's the founder of The Mill, a local news publication in Manchester.
Time now is 6 minutes to 7. There is a suggestion this morning that attacks and abuse of Muslims in London is increasing. Imam Atta is on the line, who is the director of the campaign group Tell Mama. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What can you tell us about what's going on?
So we've been documenting and the levels of anti-Muslim hatred reported into us year on year since 2012. But one of the concerning findings that we found is between 2021 and the first half of 2026, we've seen quite a significant increase in reports coming into us, specifically in London, as we've seen as well nationally on the national picture. What does that mean? In 2021, we recorded 313 reports of anti-Muslim hatred in London. We ended 2025 with 1,900 reports, the highest annual total on record that we recorded in Tell Mama in London. And in the first half of 2026, we documented over 1,000 cases, which is similar to what we documented in the whole of 2023, almost 1,000 cases as well.
What is the range then of what you're documenting? In other words, some of it presumably is abuse, some of it much worse than that.
Absolutely. One of the things that we've been seeing is a rise in aggression, street-based aggression, targeting Muslim communities. There's xenophobic rhetoric. We've seen targeting of Islamic institutions and centers. We've had cases where Muslim women have been reporting into us being called terrorists, having their headscarves ripped off, and being threatened to be killed and raped. So quite a range of cases that we're getting, including as well one of the, I think, major highlights that have been highlighted in the news recently that is reflective really of what's happening in terms of anti-Muslim hatred cases in London and its severity is the foiled terror plots that was the actions and of the foiled terror plot by the Met, where they actually arrested a teenager and charged him, and that was looking to target London mosques with explosives. So we're seeing a range of cases, including as well cases in the online space.
You mentioned the Met, and you obviously work with them and with the Mayor of London as well. Are there things that should be being done that are not being?
I think there's more coordinated work that should be done around what's happening in terms of tackling hatred and racism. And I think there's more investment and more work should be done around education and prevention. I think we talk about recording, we talk about providing support and advocacy services that I think both the mayor has invested in, but equally the Met is working on strengthening recording and investigation. But I think there's more investment that should go into education and prevention. We feel that a lot of the rhetoric, a lot of what we're seeing in London, but also nationally, sometimes is down to people not understanding nuances around Muslim communities and some of it is around ignorance. So education is key as well as prevention work.
Imam Atta, thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
Thank you.
At 4 minutes to 7, let's have a look ahead to this Sunday's drama, shall we?
Radio 4's Story of America.
New York City, please welcome Joe Buck.
The first ever audio adaptation of Midnight Cowboy.
Say, I'm new in town, looking for the Statue of Liberty.
You for real? Watch it, cowboy.
Go on, get out of here.
Dreams, desperation, and an unlikely friendship.
No, I don't like anything to do with stolen money.
Well, then you won't have anything to do with eating tonight either.
Midnight Cowboy.
No one's going to stop us this time. We're getting out.
Begins on Sunday at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Weather time, here's Helen Willetts.
Justin, thanks very much indeed. Hello there, good morning to you. The 62-day, that's over 2 months, unbroken dry spell at Wisley in Surrey is now officially over. A couple of millimetres of rain having fallen through the night. More than a couple of millimetres, though, in the showers further north, and we still have quite a significant weather front just close to the coast of southern England. So let's start here across England and Wales, and that weather front's quite active across parts of southern Devon into southern Dorset at the moment, and it will be continuing to brush its way across other southern coastal counties of England throughout the rest of this morning, eventually clearing away from Kent and Essex as we head into the early afternoon. Behind it, some sunny spells, but also a scattering of showers. Now, those showers are lighter and heavier through the day across northern England, across North Wales, to Lincolnshire, the North Midlands, and by this evening into East Anglia. And by heavy, I mean that there could be some rumbles of thunder and some hail in there as well. So we could get 5 to 10 millimetres of rain from those showers, possibly a little bit more, but because it showers, it's hit and miss, so it's not guaranteed for all. Temperatures today, as a result, will be a little lower. It's quite warm to start, not quite as warm as yesterday morning, but we're talking about highs of 20 to 24, locally 25 from north to south across England and Wales. Now, for Northern Ireland, we've already got quite a rash of heavy showers coming into Fermanagh and Tyrone right now. So further east it's drier, but those showers become more widespread and they will be quite lengthy at times and heavy, some intense downpours, which could lead to some localised flash flooding if we get 20, 30 millimetres in the space of an hour, for example, in those thunderstorms. Temperatures around about 16 to 19 degrees. And it's a similar story for Scotland. We've got a weather front just brushing across the Northern Isles, so 12 or 13 here, quite a brisk northeasterly wind setting in, but it showers elsewhere close to the area of low pressure, so actually lighter winds mean those showers will be slow moving, heavy and thundery, becoming more frequent with time. 16 to 19 the highs today, but again, some potential local flooding.
Hello, thank you. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb.
It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 19th of August. The headlines this morning: Ukraine's former defence minister has challenged President Zelensky by demanding wartime elections, claiming corruption was making it harder for the country to win. We hear from the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in Ukraine.
Putin will definitely use this as a moment of kind of division, political infighting, and he will use it in his favour. Holding elections right now, it might just bury the country.
Two other headlines. Andy Burnham has announced a drive to get thousands of rough sleepers off England's streets by Christmas. And three members of the same family have died after getting into difficulty off the coast of Sussex.
Coming up in the next hour on the programme, Sainsbury's has paused facial recognition at a London store after a customer was wrongly flagged as a shoplifter. Can you imagine? We'll be looking at whether we're ready for that technology to be used in shops, even though we know how much shoplifting is going on. And is cleaner air helping children's lungs develop better? We'll be hearing the results of a study that has looked into it.
Hello from Mike Williams with the sport, live at Headingley this morning as English cricket goes back to the future. Joe Root talks to us about his decision to return as captain of the Test side for a second time.
I had a little while thinking about it and making sure that it felt like it was the right thing for me. But once I spoke to Stephen Fleming, you know, very quickly got very excited about things and was very much looking forward to taking on the challenge of it.
But first, the BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Ukraine's former defence minister, Mikhailo Fedorov, whose sacking last month prompted mass protests, has called for elections. In a video posted online, Mr. Fedorov said Ukraine was facing a crisis of governance and corruption. He's the first senior Ukrainian politician to demand new elections, which are prohibited by law during wartime. From Kyiv, here's our Ukraine correspondent Dan Johnson.
Mikhailo Fedorov didn't name President Zelensky in his video statement, but it was a blistering critique of Ukraine's government under his leadership, with a call for a major clean-up and changes to the way the state, and therefore the war, is run. The 35-year-old sacked defence minister said democracy was not a peacetime luxury.
Democracy cannot be held hostage by Russia. We are fighting precisely because we want to remain a free European state. That is why we must find a legal, safe and realistic mechanism that will allow Ukraine to restore a full democratic process, even during a prolonged war.
Ukrainian law prevents elections during conflict, but Mr. Fedorov said trust between citizens and state had to be rebuilt and hope restored. He said corruption was depriving the military of weapons and equipment and making it harder for Ukraine to win. There have been weekly protests in support of the former minister, seen as a modernising figure who transformed the battlefield with drone warfare, but who disagreed with the head of the armed forces. He didn't rule out running in any election, and recent polls indicate he would beat President Zelensky.
The United Nations aid chief has told this programme that developments in artificial intelligence and drone warfare pose an increased risk to civilians in conflicts around the world. Tom Fletcher has been visiting the Ukrainian city of Kherson, close to the front line with Russia, where civilians have spoken of being hunted by drones. Moscow has denied targeting civilians. Tom Fletcher told us the city was seeing thousands of drone attacks every week.
Everyone I talk to knows the language of drones. They know the difference between the sound of a Shahed drone and a drone piloted by optical fibres. And it's chilling, this alliance between sort of deadly technology and warfare. You can see why there's that level of collective anxiety among the population.
You can hear more from this interview shortly after the 8 o'clock news. UK inflation rose last month to 2.9%, according to the Office for National Statistics. That's up from 2.6% in June. The change was mostly driven by the increase in the regulator Ofgem's energy price cap last month. The Prime Minister has vowed that every rough sleeper in England will be offered accommodation this winter. Andy Burnham made ending rough sleeping his first pledge on entering Downing Street and says he now wants to get everyone in for Christmas. In an article for The Guardian, he said boosting economic growth would mean nothing if people were still sleeping rough under the cranes building that new Britain. Our social affairs correspondent Michael Buchanan reports.
According to official data, almost 4,800 people were rough sleeping in England in a single night last autumn, a figure that's almost doubled since 2021, when a pandemic-era programme to protect rough sleepers from COVID-19 saw significant reductions. Andy Burnham says he hopes to build on the success of that scheme and has pledged a total of £442 million to tackle a problem he says that Westminster has started to accept. Councils and mayors will be asked to find local solutions, such as sourcing temporary accommodation in night shelters, B&Bs, flats and houses. The money will also be used to find more than 1,000 houses over the next 3 years to move rough sleepers into permanent accommodation. Homeless charities have welcomed the initiative, but the Conservatives say the Prime Minister's pledge didn't have any plan for delivery.
Police in West Sussex say three members of the same family died after getting into difficulty in the water off Shoreham-by-Sea yesterday. They're believed to be a couple and their teenage daughter. A fourth member of the family, a younger girl, was rescued but is critically ill. The local MP, Tom Rutland, said the whole community would be hoping and praying for her recovery. Sam Harrison reports from Shoreham.
Emergency services were called to Shoreham just before 3 o'clock in the afternoon, following reports that four people had got into difficulty in the water. What followed was a very large emergency response, involving a lifeboat, Coast Guard helicopters and two air ambulances. Four people were brought to shore, but it was later confirmed that a man, a woman and a teenage girl, all from the same family, had died. A younger girl is in a critical condition in hospital. Chief Superintendent James Collis is from Sussex Police.
I know this incident will have had a profound effect on the community, and inquiries are ongoing alongside our partners to understand the full details. At this point, we believe all four entered the water from the land for a swim and sadly got into difficulty.
A cordon has been lifted along the seafront at Shoreham. Anyone with information or footage of the incident is being asked to contact Sussex Police.
The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, is calling for the UK to sign up to an EU migration scheme, which he says would give ministers sweeping powers to return small boat arrivals. The party says 200,000 people have made the Channel crossing since Brexit, up from zero before the referendum. Here's our political correspondent, Alicia McCarthy.
The Pact on Migration and Asylum came into force in June, creating an EU-wide system of border controls, mandatory screening and an updated database to track migrants. The Lib Dems say signing up would give the UK the power to legally return people to the first country they entered, taking away a major pull factor created by Brexit. In exchange, some migrants would come here. There'd also be a price to joining the EU scheme, which the Lib Dems put at around £100 million a year, but they argue that's a fraction of the current costs. But Labour says it has worked more closely with the EU since it came to power, and more than 47,000 crossings have been prevented in 2 years.
A study suggests that the introduction of London's ultra-low emission zone, which aims to cut air pollution, has led to improvements in children's lung health. The ULEZ scheme was set up to discourage people from driving older, more polluting cars into the capital by charging them. Researchers at Queen Mary's University say their findings are the strongest evidence yet on how children can be protected from traffic pollution. Here's our health reporter, Smita Mundasad.
More than 3,000 primary school children in London and Luton, where there's less vehicle pollution, took part in the study. They had annual tests to measure their lung capacity and function over 5 years. At the start, the group in London had significantly lower lung capacity than their peers in Luton. But 4 years after the ultra-low emission zone was launched in London, the main measurements suggested the group in the city had all but caught up. Over the same period, levels of nitrogen dioxide, a polluting gas from vehicle exhausts, fell faster in London than Luton, suggesting that the ULEZ had contributed to these improvements. Researchers say it's important to consider the impact of other factors, including COVID restrictions that were in place during part of the study.
The Queen has described the pressure of keeping the King's cancer diagnosis secret in the early stages of his treatment. Camilla was speaking in a video released by Buckingham Palace to mark the 30th anniversary of the cancer charity Maggie's, of which she is the president. The Queen talks about officially opening the charity's support centre in London in January 2024, before news of her husband's cancer was made public.
That was quite difficult. I almost said something, but you know, I felt that it wasn't the time to say. Looked at everybody who was suffering and all the relations, and I think it made me realise even more how important these places were. I was just longing to let it out, but obviously I couldn't.
Queen Camilla speaking there.
Jane, thank you very much. It's 9 minutes past seven. A crisis of governance and wartime corruption. It is time for an election. An election during a war. That is the cry that has gone up in Ukraine by the country's ousted defence minister, Mykhailo Fedorov. He made the comments last night on YouTube just weeks after he was sacked by President Zelensky. Now he wants his former boss out. Mr. Fedorov made those comments in a video. You can hear a clip here.
We must answer a fundamental question. How should the state function if the war lasts for years? Can Russia in effect gain the right to decide when Ukrainians will again be able to elect their authorities? I am convinced that it cannot.
There were mass protests when he was fired. He had been seen by many as transforming Ukraine's armed forces. But beyond a case of sour grapes and potential revenge for losing his job, does he have a point? How much longer can President Zelensky carry on? Well, there are some legal matters around this, which we're going to hear about in a moment. But his five-year term as president was due to end in May 2024. But elections have been suspended in Ukraine since martial law was declared after Russia's full-scale invasion in February 2022. Oleksandr Mereshko is the chair of Ukraine's Foreign Affairs Committee and an MP with President Zelensky's Servant of the People Party. He started by giving me his reaction to Mr. Fedorov's call for an election.
I think it's a mistake because it's a very dangerous and unrealistic idea under the circumstances. First of all, it's impossible to hold elections during the martial law. It's prohibited by our constitution, for example, to hold parliamentary elections. Presidential elections, theoretically, they can be held, but we need changes in our legislation, which makes it difficult. But most importantly, politically, it's very dangerous because Putin will definitely use this as a moment of kind of division, political infighting, and he will use it in his favor. So the thing is that holding elections right now, it might just bury the country.
But it's been a long time, hasn't it? And there are growing voices and the volume of those voices are growing against President Zelensky and concerns whether he's the right person to be leading.
Well, it's normal for democracy, for vibrant democracy, and Ukraine remains to be a democratic country in this respect. So there are different views, but at the same time, presidential ratings, they remain high enough, especially compared with the European leaders. So, and president, he's eager to listen to people, and we have parliament which is functioning. We have all institutions of democratic country, democratic society.
But in getting rid of, for instance, Mr. Fedorov last month, you know, which there was a lot of protest against, our understanding is, you know, was that the right decision? There's, you know, questions around whether he's making the right choices.
Well, from my perspective, I believe that Mr. Federer should have been reinstated because I don't see the reason why he was dismissed. For me, he proved to be a quite effective minister, and he was in his position for only 6 months. So, and he was quite effective. So that's why I personally don't understand this decision. But at the same time, I assume that president knows better situation and it's up to him to decide with whom he's comfortable to work with.
But I suppose if you don't agree with it, and there was also mass protests against it, that does show that you say about democracy working, but how else can people demonstrate that perhaps there is a different way, or perhaps, you know, the defence of the country should be handled differently? Surely you could argue it's more critical to have an election so, you know, so long now after this invasion.
Legally, it's impossible because we need to change constitution. And again, according to the constitution, it cannot be changed during the martial law. So we have sort of legal deadlock in this regard.
But just talking, if I may, about legal side of things, you know, he's also warned, as well as a crisis of governance for Ukraine, about wartime corruption. What's he talking about?
Well, I believe that he is making this statement on the basis of his experience in the Ministry of Defense. But at the same time, I believe that if he has such suspicions or claims, he should turn to law enforcement agencies. We have a special anti-corruption agency, for example, and he should provide information and facts about this. It's a very important claim, important statement, but he needs to prove it.
President Zelensky's office has no immediate comment to Mr. Fedorov's statement, to this video, to this challenge to his authority. But I mean, how long do you think President Zelensky can then stay in post? What do you envision?
Till the end of war, by that I mean lifting martial law, because it's crucial, it's important. And besides, we need to create logistical, I would say, grounds for holding elections. Having 8 million Ukrainian citizens abroad and having a huge army, it's difficult, even from logistical point of view, to hold elections. We need to change legislation to create conditions, and most importantly, safety for the voters. It's impossible to imagine, for example, in Kyiv yesterday we had 10 times air raid sirens going off. So under these circumstances, it's impossible to guarantee the safety for the voters.
Alexander Mureshko, thank you.
Thank you.
16 minutes past seven. The Liberal Democrats say they have a solution to the small boats influx of migrants across the channel. It involves a financial cost and a duty to take some migrants, but it would otherwise be a solution. Let's talk to Max Wilkinson, the Liberal Democrats Home Affairs spokesperson, who's on the line. Morning to you.
Morning, Justin.
What are you suggesting?
Well, we're suggesting that we should, as a country, join the EU Migration and Asylum Pact. And we think that's the best way to stop small boat crossings, because it would give us access to a proper returns agreement with the European Union. That's way in advance of the current government's one-in-one-out agreement with only France, which, of course, doesn't include Belgium, where some of the small boats currently leave. It would give us access to the biometric data of people who are applying for asylum. So that would stop the double dipping, which we currently see when migrants apply for asylum in the EU and then they apply again in the UK, which is one of the key drivers towards asylum seekers getting to the north coast of France. It would also mean that we have a safe and orderly system, and it would mean that asylum seekers that we would be taking in the UK would be part of a system where they are claiming in the first country where they arrive. And of course, at the moment, one of the key concerns that many British people have is that asylum seekers have been through several safe countries before they arrive in the UK in the first place.
But you see them in France, where they've been through safe countries. This system, the EU Migration and Asylum Pact, has not worked in that way for those people, has it? In other words, they've got to France.
Well, the asylum pact was only brought in a couple of months ago. It is already creating order within the European Union's flows of asylum seekers. Part of the problem that we have, of course, is that since we had Brexit, we have had the small boats crisis, and having the border that's been created at the north coast of France and on the southeast coast of England is one of the reasons why we have small boat crossings in the first place.
We had a huge problem with people trying to get over on lorries and trains, didn't we, well before the Brexit vote?
It was a far smaller group of people who were trying to get over in that way. And of course, it is not realistic to suggest that there will be no flows of asylum seekers anywhere in the world at any time. The world is an increasingly dangerous and difficult place for lots of people. But what we have a responsibility to do is to insert order into that system and fairness. Now, the other parties, Justin, the Labour Party's got its one-in-one-out agreement with France, which hasn't really worked. It's not a proper deterrent. The Conservatives have suggested ripping up our rights by leaving the ECHR, and that is not going to deter a single small boat crossing. And the Reform Party has suggested the ECHR departure, but also deploying the Navy into the Channel, removing our brave service people from fighting against...
I just want to concentrate on yours, though, on your plan. What are you suggesting, then, that if people came across in these circumstances where we were a member of the EU Migrant and Asylum Pact, that in those circumstances anyone who came across could simply be sent back?
If they arrived on a small boat, then certainly they would be returned to the EU and they would be processed in the first country of arrival within the European Union or any signatory to the EU Migration and Asylum Pact. That's the thing that restores order to the asylum system. And of course, we have a historic responsibility and we've done it very well in this country. But what people expect is for that responsibility to look after the world's poorest people, to be orderly and for it to be safe. No one wants to see people crossing on small boats because it's unsafe. It gives the impression that the country has lost control of its systems, and we need to put that right. The only way we're going to do it, Justin, is by working with our nearest allies.
And just a brief thought then, because part of this scheme, isn't it, is that people do take asylum seekers into their own countries. What sort of numbers would we be talking about then?
Well, in the first place, it would mean that we would stop the small boat crossings, and that is one of the key concerns for voters. But also, it would be a smaller number than currently arrive by boat. And of course, as part of the pact, you'd have the opportunity to make financial contributions or take people who are part of the asylum system in the EU. So there would be an opportunity for the UK to be part of those negotiations. Justin, this is an actual serious solution to the small boats problem. The other parties are just tinkering around the edges, or they're suggesting things that are not going to work. They're not going to deter a single small boat. This EU Migration Pact will do so.
We'll put it to the other parties when they come on to talk about these things, which, of course, they quite often do. Max Wilkinson for the Liberal Democrats. Thank you.
It's 20 past seven. Prices rose by a faster rate of 2.9% in the year to July as higher energy prices kicked in. Sean, can you help us make some sense of this?
Yeah, well, we will attempt to. This is in line with most expectations. It's the Consumer Prices Index rate of inflation. So last time round, it came in at 2.6%. It's now gone up for the first time since March. So that's prices rising more quickly for the first time since March. I've got Mike Hardy with me, who's Deputy Director of Prices at the Office for National Statistics. Very useful to have to try and make more sense of all of these as they have released these figures. Mike, good morning. Is it all about energy prices?
It is mainly about energy prices. So as you said, inflation accelerated in July, rising to 2.9%. And that's the first time the rate has increased since March this year. And this was mainly driven by a sharp increase in gas and, to a lesser extent, electricity prices following this month's change to the Ofgem energy price cap. The rise in gas prices was the largest for almost 4 years. To a lesser extent, there were upward contributions from furniture and clothing. Although prices fell for these categories between June and July, this was by less than the same 2 months a year ago.
Right.
There were some offsetting contributions as well. So we had downward contributions from motor fuels, with diesel and petrol prices falling between June and July.
And I guess that's all a little bit relative, isn't it? People might not necessarily feel like petrol and diesel prices are a lot lower than they once were, but that's a more recent fall.
Yes. Yeah. So I referred to the change between June and July, but prices have been increasing steadily since March this year.
Now, over the year in these numbers, it shows that food prices were rising at their slowest rate for almost 5 years. What's been behind that?
Yeah, that's correct. So a little bit of a mixed bag with food prices. So food prices rose by 1.3% in the 12 months to July, and that's slightly down from the previous month. The larger of these downward effects came from meat, so particularly beef and breaded chicken. Other smaller downward effects came from vegetables, sugar, jam, honey, syrups, chocolate and confectionaries. And there were small upward effects from bread and cereal and from fish.
Yeah, I noticed there's some numbers out today in making headlines. Grocery inflation hitting a two-year low with some latest data from World Panel about August data, which we haven't got yet from the Office for National Statistics. What you also do put out today, Mike, is how prices are being impacted for those producing a lot of these goods. And those price rises slowing down as well. Are there signs, would you say, in here that price rises later in the year may not be as high as some thought?
So we produce two types of statistics regarding businesses. So output prices, so the price at the factory gate of finished products, and input prices, so the products used in the production process. And the numbers we published this morning show that both have slowed in July. So output prices from 3.5% to 3.1% and input prices from 7.4% to 4.9%. But similar to the petrol prices that you mentioned, it's useful to put these in a historic context, and prices for both have been rising since the start of the year.
Right, great. Mike, thank you for your time. Mike Hardy there, Deputy Director of Prices at the ONS. Just a little bit of breaking news as well. The competition regulator has launched an investigation into how Trainline, Virgin Atlantic and Red Driving School show customers their total pricing when make a booking, called drip pricing. So that's another investigation from that regulator on its way.
Sean, thank you for that. 24 minutes past seven is the time. There is a claim this morning that the ultra-low emissions area in London has improved children's lung health, but it's a claim disputed by some. Let's talk to Dr. Helen Wood, Research Fellow at Queen Mary University of London, lead author of the study that has led to this claim. Good morning.
Morning.
So the Guardian headline this morning is ULEZ led to lung boost for children in London. No question at all about that. I think what you're actually saying is more nuanced, isn't it? But tell us what it is that you think the study has discovered.
Thank you. So we found the strongest evidence yet that an effective clean air zone can reduce some of the harm caused to children by air pollution. We found that children in London had significantly smaller lungs before the ULEZ was introduced, and over the following 4 years they recovered their lung function to catch up with children in Luton, where there wasn't a low emission zone.
How much of that is could have been, though, the result of COVID? Because that COVID covers this period, doesn't it?
Well, COVID was during the 5 years of our study, but the lockdown periods actually only covered 16 weeks of the time during our five-year study, and the lockdowns would have been the same for the London children and the Luton children. So we don't think that it accounted for much of the effect. It's also been shown in a recent systemic review that there was no lasting impact of mild to moderate COVID infections on lung development in children.
Because Professor Stephen Burgess, Professor of Biostatistics at the University of Cambridge, is not at all convinced, it is fair to say. He says how much of this change is attributable to reductions in air pollution isn't clear. Other changes in behaviour around the ULEZ transition, an increase in active trans travel to school, etc., etc. So it could be that lung function is attributable to greater levels of physical activity. It's frustrating, isn't it? And it'll be frustrating for you as well that you can't make the direct claim. But your view is that there is, that the correlation is clear enough and interesting enough for it to be relevant.
We've done the best kind of study that you can. It's a real world experiment of a real life public health intervention, comparing the ULEZ in London with a similar town that didn't have a clean air zone. And given you can't undertake a randomised trial with this scenario, you can't take a bunch of children and put them in a place with clean air versus a bunch of children and put them somewhere with dirty air, then this is the best kind of research that you can do when you're looking at epidemiology.
And is it research then that is strong enough that other parts of the UK, other cities, should be looking at it seriously and saying we should follow?
Well, I'm not a policymaker, I'm just a scientist, but I would hope that our policymakers and our elected politicians would look closely at this evidence that we've produced, because it's an important study. It's a very big study, and it's the first study to show an improvement in lung growth associated with a reduction in air pollution following a public health intervention targeting vehicle
emissions. And of course, when we talk about lung growth, and particularly in young children, it's not just that the ability they've got to breathe more easily, it is likely to have an impact on their longer term adult health as well.
Absolutely. It's well recognised that the size of the lungs when you reach adulthood has an impact on health throughout life. So ending up with not reaching your maximal lung capacity, having smaller lungs when you reach adulthood, is associated with an increased risk, not just of lung disease, but also cardiovascular disease, metabolic disease, and early death.
Dr. Helen Wood, Research Fellow at Queen Mary University of London. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At 28 minutes past seven, shall we head back to Leeds? Mike Williams is somewhere special with the sports news today. Is it raining on your head?
It's not, Emma. No, I'm delighted to say the sun has poked out of the Yorkshire sky away to my left, burning away any remnants of that overnight rain. The covers are still on at the moment here at Headingley, where a new era for English cricket begins today in the first test against Pakistan. Well, a new era of sorts, because England have a new test captain, but it is a very familiar face. Joe Root, England's highest ever run scorer, is the man who has taken up the captaincy for a second time. He replaces Ben Stokes, who retired from test cricket last month, of course. So Root returns and does so here at Headingley, his home ground.
To start here at Headingley, a ground where we all enjoy playing, we've had success here, I think makes for brilliant test match cricket as well. I think it's the best surface in the country for the format. If we can manage those conditions well and have good answers to the questions that are asked of us from Pakistan, you know, we'll be in a good place at the end of the week.
And you can hear more from our chats with Joe Root in the next hour of the programme. Right now, I'm delighted to say that sitting alongside me here at Headingley is Sanjay Patel, CEO of Yorkshire County Cricket Club. Many thanks for joining us and coming in early to speak to us today. So a big day for Yorkshire, and a big day for one of your own, Joe Root, returning to the England captaincy at his home ground.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing for Joe. We're also proud of him here at Yorkshire County Cricket Club. He's an amazing guy. He deserves everything that he gets. And yeah, we just hope that he can lead England to test victory at his home ground in the next 5 days.
And alongside Harry Brook as well, the white ball captain, another Yorkshire player as well. So big day today, big 5 days away for Yorkshire. But looking slightly further ahead, we were just talking off air, this is the start of a bit of a barren spell for Yorkshire in terms of men's internationals. No test in 2027, no test in 2028 either. You must have been particularly disappointed next year to have missed out on an Ashes test match.
Yeah, we are. Look, we have the Women's Ashes test match next year, so we're delighted to be hosting that. But we don't have a men's test match in 27, and we've got no men's test match in 28. And that's got a devastating effect on our business. But also, I think, for the people of Yorkshire and everyone who loves cricket in Yorkshire, I think that for them to miss out on seeing test cricket is a great shame. So we're very disappointed, but we're also aware that we need to change a few things here at Yorkshire and make sure that we invest properly in the stadium and our facilities so next time around we don't miss out.
And you do have one scheduled, I know, for 2029, but that will be outside of the main test series against India that year. You mentioned the changes that you would like to see here at Yorkshire. It is, like most counties, a members-run club, isn't it? It has been for its history, 170-odd years. But I know that you are calling for that to change to allow for more outside investment into the county.
Yeah, I mean, financially over the last 25 years, this club has struggled. We haven't been able to invest the appropriate amount of money in our strategy or our stadium or our facilities. We're at the point now where we're losing test cricket and we're losing major international cricket. And if we want cricket in Yorkshire to be strong, we need to make sure that these matches stay here at Headingley. We've also got a very ambitious strategy with Chasing Glory, which we've just recently launched. And we need investment to make sure that cricket in Yorkshire is strong, not only from a club point of view, but from a recreational point of view, and everybody who's involved in cricket in this county.
Is that going to be a tough sell there to your members?
I think so. I mean, I think right now there's probably some members who understand it and are very supportive, and there's also members who have got a lot of questions, but that's okay. Our job for the next 3 months is to make sure that we answer all those questions, we give people all the facts and the details, and then ultimately this is going to be a member's choice, so they will make the choice whether we remain a member's club or whether we convert to a private limited company and get external investment in. But what I will say is, if they want cricket to thrive in Yorkshire, I genuinely believe that the way forward is for us to demutualise and become a private limited company.
Appreciate you joining us on what is a very busy day for you and for Yorkshire. That is Sanjay Patel, Chief Executive of Yorkshire County Cricket Club. And just to say, away from here, just down the road, in fact, 20-odd miles or so, we have some tips on the first day of the Ebor Festival at York for you today, one of British Racing's prize pots. I know you're excited, Justin. Here are the selections. Get your pencil ready.
I have it.
The first one, in the 150 is number 18, Air Force One, an American theme there. And in 3-4, and at the 335, our selection is number 9, Item.
Thank you for that. Also excited as Michael Burke is here in the studio with a preview of tonight's Moral Maze.
According to Robert Jenrick of the Reform Party, Britain's ballooning welfare budget is immoral as well as unaffordable. Benefits for the disabled in particular, he said, were not generosity, but suicidal empathy. The idea that empathy may not be an unqualified virtue is not new and has been voiced by some philosophers who say it can be destructive if misdirected, and the world's richest man, Elon Musk, who calls it the fundamental weakness of Western civilization. Empathy, the emotional root of morality and society's cement, or a potential liability we must sometimes withhold. The Moral Maze, after the news at 8 tonight.
Coming up in a few minutes' time, a nationwide salmonella outbreak has left one person dead and hundreds ill. Investigators focusing on food made with imported eggs. We will look at what we know about the outbreak.
We'll also be heading over to Kew Gardens, which I'll be able to tell you some more about when I learn a bit more about, but they've entered the water lily way off. What better way to promote plants than by stepping on them? More of that and on, but can I just say, on a personal note, before I introduce Jane back here with the news, I have missed this, being in the bosom of the Today programme for quite a few weeks. I've had to listen from home. I've said I've had to, but, you know, it was a pleasure, Justin. And just to say, in the spirit of honesty, as I always try to be with our listeners, as you are with me, and a few of you have been kind enough to get in touch to ask, I made a programme on the BBC about endometriosis on BBC Two, and ended up being in hospital for endometriosis in a case of life imitating work, being held to account by my own film there. So, been recuperating, shall we say, from surgery for endometriosis and a hysterectomy to boot. So that's been less fun than the Today programme, but it is lovely to be back. You've missed me, obviously.
And you are very welcome back.
Thank you.
You are very welcome back indeed.
Well, I don't need to tell you are listening to Today after that on Radio 4, but I'll remind you, with Justin Webb and me, Emma Barnett, it's 25 minutes to 8, and now we have a summary of the news from someone else I've missed, Jane Steele.
Ukraine's former defence minister, Mykhailo Fedorov, has become the country's first senior political figure to call for wartime elections to be held, saying the country was facing a systemic crisis of governance. His dismissal by President Zelensky last month sparked mass protests across the country. The former minister made the comments in a YouTube video, arguing democracy couldn't be held hostage by Russia. Figures from the Office for National Statistics show that UK inflation rose to 2.9% in the 12 months to July, up from 2.6% in the year to June. The change was mostly driven by the increase in the regulator Ofgem's energy price cap last month. The Chancellor, John Healey, said the war in the Middle East was continuing to affect prices at home, but the British economy was resilient. The Prime Minister, Andy Burnham, has pledged to give all rough sleepers in England a route to get off the streets this Christmas as part of his plans to tackle homelessness. Mr Burnham says he will call on the support of business, faith and community leaders at a summit this autumn. Sussex police say three members of the same family, a man, a woman and a teenage girl, have died after getting into difficulty in the water off Shoreham-by-Sea. Officers say a younger girl from the same family was rescued but is in a critical condition in hospital. The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, says the UK should join the EU's Migration and Asylum Pact to give the government the power to return migrants crossing on small boats to the first EU country they entered. Joining the scheme could cost around £100 million a year. A study suggests that the introduction of London's ultra-low emission zone, which aims to cut air pollution, has led to improvements in children's lung health. Researchers monitored primary school pupils in the capital and in Luton and found their lung capacity improved over a five-year period. They say it's important to consider the impact of other factors, including COVID restrictions that were in place during part of the study.
Thank you for that. It is 23 minutes to 8. A person has died and hundreds have fallen ill with salmonella food poisoning in an outbreak that UK experts say is linked to eating food made with imported eggs. Let us talk to Paul Wigley, who's professor in animal microbial ecosystems at the Bristol Veterinary School, and to Mark Williams, who is chair of the British Egg Industry Council. Morning to you both.
Good morning. Morning.
Paul Wigley, first of all, tell us what we know. What is it that we're looking at here? Is this an isolated outbreak? Is this something more than that?
That's a very interesting question. So Salmonella enteritidis, the form of Salmonella, is the most common form of Salmonella in humans in the UK. We tend to get about 3,000 cases through the year generally. We don't tend to see very many large outbreaks such as this. So to put in context, the levels of Salmonella in the UK used to be considerably higher. So you can go back to Edwina Curry's statement in 1988. And back in those days, egg production in the UK had a lot of Salmonella. Now, as I'm sure Mark will tell you, we've come a long way since then through the use of vaccination, through surveillance and detecting Salmonella in flocks. So it's become a very rare event, if not almost zero Salmonella from UK-produced lion mark eggs. However, we do still import a large number of eggs and egg product, and Salmonella could be contained within these because the countries in which they're produced, typically places like Poland, Ukraine and Hungary, don't use that same level of control.
Is it as simple as that, Mark Williams, that we have made British eggs pretty much completely safe, as Paul Wigley was saying there, but other countries haven't managed to do it?
Yeah, good morning. Absolutely, that is correct. Following what happened 38 years ago, which is very much consigned to history now, the industry addressed its problem and brought into play what we call the British Lion Quality Scheme. And that mandated that every single laying hen had to be vaccinated against Salmonella. Hygiene standards and biosecurity standards were vastly improved on British farms. And effectively, now we have the gold standard for egg production anywhere in the world. And when this report was released yesterday, of course, it's very concerning. And it's simply not fair to all the British farmers that have done their very best to make British eggs safe, and that we've seen all their efforts undermined by imported eggs, which simply are not produced to the same high standards.
And if you're buying an egg, buying eggs in a supermarket or a shop, Mark, you can tell immediately, can you, that they're British or not?
Yes, I mean, if I may, just to set the scene, roughly 2/3 of all the eggs eaten in the UK are sold in shell at retail level. So it's not a retail issue, this, okay? Because all those eggs will have the British Lion mark on the shell, so consumers are reassured. However, about 20% of the eggs consumed are sold to what we call the food service sector, so prisons, schools, hospitals, restaurants, etc. In other words, non-retail. And about 16% are taken out of a shell and made into a variety of egg products. Now, the issue is the latter two sectors are very price conscious. So that tends to attract imports. So food businesses, of course, who caterers, restaurants or whatever may wish to go and buy eggs. So what we're saying, and those eggs could be imported. So what we're saying, it is really important that those food businesses check their supply lines, you know, ask to see that their hens have been vaccinated against salmonella and that they all the food safety checks have been done on them.
In which case, at the moment, Paul Wigley, the obvious thing to do would be to let those businesses know where the eggs have come from that have led to this outbreak. Is it as simple as that? Could that be done, do you think?
I think it can be quite challenging. These are often very bulk purchases of eggs. So you or I may buy half a dozen or a dozen eggs, whereas obviously a caterer may be buying eggs by the thousand, which may be of mixed origin as well. I think one of the problems is we need to be absolutely sure of the source before we say, you know, these are eggs from X, Y, or Z country. And as yet, we don't have that original source. Now, we know almost certainly through the genomic evidence that this is through imported eggs. We've seen very similar forms of this salmonella in recent years from imported eggs. But we haven't yet got that, you know, that absolute smoking gun of detecting the salmonella within an egg from a specific country. So it would be very difficult. But as Mark says, it would be far more sensible if we did have that level of control, of traceability. You know, Lion Mark eggs are stamped. You can work back to which farm they're produced in, how they're produced. So that level is just not there.
How much more control do you think it's reasonable, Mark Williams, for the UK to exert? I mean, how much could be exerted? Could we, for instance, name countries? I mean, as Paul Wigley says, it'd be difficult to do in a mixed batch of eggs, but I mean, would it be helpful at least to know what country we thought in this case, because I don't think the government is naming any country, but we thought these eggs had come from?
Well, that's correct at this moment in time, and as Paul rightly says, the use of whole genome sequencing now can almost get us to the smoking gun, but because we consume the eggs from 40 billion eggs per year here in the UK. That's 14 billion. So that's 40 million eggs a day are consumed, okay, of which about 35 million are UK produced. So the balance is imported. So there is a lot of eggs coming in from different countries. A lot of those will be other EU member states. Some will be coming from wider afield. Paul mentioned Ukraine, for example. So the issue is quite simply this, is that eggs which come into this country, the import checks are done on a risk-based basis. This episode, and remember, this is a repeat of what happened in 2025, and the whole genome sequencing links back to an outbreak in 2025 as well. This surely highlights now that government needs to increase those risk-based checks at when eggs are imported into this country. And that may be, dare I say it, actually holding eggs until they are salmonella checked, and those salmonella checks can take a few days to do.
Mark Williams, Chair of the British Egg Industry Council, and Paul Wigley from Bristol Veterinary School. Thank you both.
It's 7:45. Now, of all the ways to promote the power and majesty of plants, how about stepping on them to see if they can bear your weight? I'm not joking. That is what's been happening at Kew Gardens. It's not the only place, but Kew Gardens, of course, in London, which has apparently entered the water lily way off. Alex Summers, the Curator of Living Collections at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew. Good morning.
Good morning there, Emma.
What's going on? People are standing on water lilies. Tell me more. I'm just getting used to this today, but go on.
Yeah, no. I think if you look at the social media post, it is as crazy as you say, but equally, I think we do it for a very good reason, which is, as you say, celebrating the majesty and diversity of the plant kingdom. And any route we can get out there to do that is fantastic. So in the case here, the water lily way off, across about 40 botanic gardens and zoos globally, we all grow these large water lilies. Many people will be familiar with them because when they come through botanic gardens, they'll see them, these massive leaves up to 3 meters in the case of the plants we're growing in the pools at Kew here. And those leaves can bear a massive weight. So the question is, who can put the largest weight on the lily pads that they grow?
I mean, I had no idea, because underneath these
pads, these lily pads, it's a strong sort of rib cage, isn't it? That's why it can, it doesn't look, even if it looks big, you don't necessarily know it's strong.
No, it's a super light structure. So essentially you've got a structure there, a leaf, as many people will be familiar with, and the veins of the leaf. So if anybody looks under a leaf that they've got at home, they'll see that they'll have these protruding vein structures. They are really, really prominent in these Victoria water lilies. They allow the leaf structure to be very strong, and they have these rigid air pockets in them, and that allows them to carry an enormous amount of weight. In the sense of what we've done here at Kew, obviously one of our gardeners, he stood on it, and he's not one of our smaller gardeners either, 102 kilos.
Does he know he's being referred to on the Today programme as an enormous weight?
Martin does know
being put on a water lily. Yeah.
We went from a median level garden.
Oh.
To make sure that we had somebody who gave us a good chance of winning the competition. I think last year it was about 83 kilos that somebody put on a leaf, which is considerable. I mean, if you imagine, most leaves certainly couldn't take 83 kilos, and this year we've managed to go with 102 kilos. So maybe we'll win across that network of botanic gardens.
And when you were thinking about what to put on this lily pad, a person was the best that you could come up with?
Well, we kicked off with baked beans because tins of baked beans are an obvious UK item to load onto a lily pad. We moved up, we put about 80 kilos of beans, but clearly the leaf could take. So we moved on to one of our gardeners. But I think it is worth saying we are in a really fortunate spot because the Victoria water lily that we've actually entered on, it was described in 2022. We work with partners in Bolivia, so Victoria Boliviana. And so we do have somewhat of an advantage because it is within this group of water lilies, it's the one with the largest pads, and we're one of the few people to grow it globally. But it does equally highlight how amazing the plant kingdom is, how much there is still to discover.
Well, I can't believe that you can stand on it, or rather one of your gardeners can, and those who care so much about it. But there you go, the water lily way off. If that's not a way to get people interested in plants, I'm not quite sure what is. But Alex Summers, thank you for telling us about it.
Just to say, at 12 minutes to 8, that we are going to be hearing in a few moments' time about Sainsbury's, that has paused its facial recognition at least one London store after a customer was wrongly flagged as a shoplifter. We'll be looking at whether we're ready for the technology to be used more widely in shops. But now it is time for Thought for the Day, and the speaker here in the studio this morning is Mona Siddiqui, who's Professor of Religion and Society at King's College London. Good morning.
Good morning. What does it mean to erase a woman? You don't have to kill her, you can simply make her invisible. Tell her she can't get a higher education, she can't work freely. Tell her where she can go, who she can speak to, and how loudly she can speak. Eventually, you don't need to silence her, because her absence has been made normal. 5 years after the Taliban returned to power in Afghanistan, women and girls have told the BBC their lives are unrecognisable under the rule of the regime. The Taliban's foreign minister, Amir Khan Muttaqi, was asked by the BBC about education for girls in Afghanistan, to which he replied that it isn't correct to say everything is banned for women. Women aren't totally restricted in all walks of life. Only one small part is restricted until further notice. And while there is some disagreement within the Taliban, as well as condemnation from Muslim voices and organisations, those who rule say they are doing this in the name of Islam. But it seems to me that a government that needs to control the movement, clothing, education and voice of women in the name of morality, a morality that requires women to disappear, isn't showing strength. It's showing fear dressed as piety. Because to some extent across all faiths, religious authority which says, we know what God wants, always conveniently discovers that what God wants looks remarkably like what the religious authorities want. And that's why gradually the word woman is ignored from the Quranic verses, which speak of the moral agency of the believing men and believing women, the devout men and devout women, the truthful men and the truthful women. Today, the women of Afghanistan have become a political and theological test. But perhaps the most dangerous thing is the possibility that the world will eventually become accustomed to it, because oppression has a final victory, not when people are silenced, but when their silence no longer disturbs us. And yet, despite all of this, many women tell the BBC, one day everything will change, but we must continue with patience, and we will not lose hope. A government can close a school, it can close a university, it can close a woman's workplace, but it can't totally destroy the future she imagines. In the words of the Afghan poet Nadia Anjuman, who wrote in her poem, "My garden, I will trust the meaning of hope. I will shut the door on grief and find another path."
And that was Thought for the Day with Mona Siddiqui. It brings us to 8:09.
Sainsbury's has suspended its use of live facial recognition technology at one of its London branches after a customer was wrongly challenged as a shoplifter. Can you imagine? Well, Matt Arnold doesn't need to imagine. It happened to him. He was shopping at the store in East Dulwich in South London, and he spoke to our colleagues at Five Live about what happened.
I scanned everything through on the sort of self-service trolley checkout. Now, I waved to the member of staff, which, again, I don't think is particularly how a shoplifter might behave, but the reason I waved to him was, obviously, I was buying alcohol. I had to get it approved. So he came over, and he then says to me, "We can't serve you." But I was just shocked. I thought he was joking, I'll be honest. I thought it was a joke. And then I said, "Why?" And he sort of said something like, "Because of what happened earlier in the week, you know why. You've been flagged by the AI."
Well, the supermarket has said it's now apologised to Mr. Arnold, and both the shop and technology provider have insisted that the AI component of this, the artificial intelligence usage, was correct, but it was human error, the interpretation, that was to blame. Are we ready to embrace facial recognition for such security? And we know the huge rates of shoplifting and also the abuse of retail staff. Or should this give pause for thought? Silky Carlo's here, the director of the Civil Liberties Group, Big Brother Watch. And so is Andrew Goodacre, Chief Executive Officer at the British Independent Retailers Association. Good morning to you both. Andrew, this hasn't worked on this occasion. Is it working more often than not? And is that good enough? Because I'm trying to imagine how you would feel if you'd been Mr. Arnold.
Yeah, good morning. No, it hasn't worked on this occasion, but this technology and other variations of it are widely used by retailers throughout the UK. It isn't perfect, clearly. It is prone to error. But I think this is a chance to revise what's happening, to improve what's doing, but to remove it altogether from the fight against crime or this type of crime would be a backward step. You know, it had been such a huge increase.
But retailers
have had to take these measures.
But what if he hadn't been in a situation, Mr. Arnold, where he'd been believed? You know, you sort of get into these nightmarish, dystopian, Orwellian moments sometimes in systems where you're not listened to.
Yes, and that's the learning from this, isn't it? That if it's challenged by the customer, that the shop, whoever owns that shop, does need to have a system in place to make sure that the system is working to the best that it can, and has to listen to the customers, absolutely. But I think we have to put it in the context. I think this is the first case I've heard of, and this kind of technology has been around now for a couple of years, so it is working in the way we hoped it would work.
Because the key part of how it works is also that once you've highlighted somebody, they don't come back, and then also potentially action can also be taken. Yeah. Silky Carlo, let me bring you in at this point, director of Big Brother Watch. As Andrew just said, this is very rare in terms of how it's been reported so far, the use of this technology and this sort of mistake. On balance, it's still the right direction of travel.
Good morning. Well, I'm afraid I have to correct Andrew. This isn't rare at all. He should have a look at my inbox, which is absolutely full of people who are contacting Big Brother Watch, who are in exactly these circumstances. They go to their local shop or supermarket and they are thrown out, told that they've been flagged. They don't know why. They are not given any evidence. They're not given any opportunity to defend themselves. And this is incredibly dangerous because millions of people are now being scanned by live facial recognition, in large part down to Sainsbury's, that has done the biggest rollout of any retailer. And of course, even if the technology works very well, a small inaccuracy rate across millions of people results in thousands upon thousands of errors.
Is that the level you're seeing, though? I mean, obviously, you're one organisation, but can you give us a sense of how big it's been in your inbox?
Well, even in the last year, we've had scores of people contact us. And bear in mind, the research that somebody needs to do to even get to that point, because what we often find is that they're given such little information in the store that it's very hard for them to start to work out what they need to do. The steps are very prohibitive. In order to even engage with the company about this, you need to send them more data. You need to send them your driving license or passport so that they'll start talking
Silky,
to you.
So from your experience, just so I can put this clearly back to Andrew and what you're hearing, is people are being banned from the local store, but they don't know why, rather than being arrested.
Exactly. That's an important feature of this. This is distinctly a non-police process. This is privatised AI policing that discards all of the principles of fairness and justice that we're used to. If you end up on one of these watch lists, you can be not only banned from that store, but electronically blacklisted from a string of stores that use the same technology. And we're speaking to people to whom this has happened. There is no opportunity.
But maybe they did it, Silke.
In some cases, of course, people are going to correctly be put on watch lists. I think the question
they're just annoyed to be caught. But sorry, finish that point.
Well, I think the point that we need to ask is this really proportionate? Is it really proportionate that retailers are conducting basically surreptitious ID checks on millions of innocent paying customers and putting us all at the risk of serious errors and misidentifications?
You've got a very short moment to reply, but the lack of police and those rules may concern people, understandably.
As far as I'm aware, the police are not against this kind of technology at all. I think we're part of a retail crime forum, as Sainsbury's are and other large retailers, working with chief inspectors and police forces in England and Wales. And they're fully aware that this technology is being used. I understand that the point that it's not perfect. And we don't want customers to feel aggrieved or wrongly accused. But the proportional aspect is, you know, I represent people who own their own businesses who are losing money because people are taking their stock from them. They're being mugged every day. It's their word. So the proportional aspect is, how do we stop it if we don't take these kind of actions and experiment and try to find ways of stopping people or deterring them from stealing from hardworking individuals?
Definitely a debate. Andrew Goodacre, Silke Carlo. Thank you.
On BBC iPlayer.
I am going to have to look at the body.
He's back for a brand new series.
Oh, no, it's a really horrible one. I knew it would be. Hello, John Taylor, puzzle consultant.
Crime scene consultant.
That does sound more like an actual job.
Starring David Mitchell and Anna Maxwell Martin.
You'll be straightened and out.
That's what you said last time.
Ludwig.
It really is a game. And I think I have a move you can use.
Starts tomorrow on BBC iPlayer.
Talking of moves, Helen Willits is here. What's moving the weather?
Low pressure, Emma, is moving our weather at the moment, which means that having been static for a lot of this summer, hot and dry, we've now got low pressure and weather fronts. So for England and Wales, the rain in the south will clear by the end of the morning, but linger in the Channel Islands, some really heavy rain here. And then for the rest of us, for the majority of the day, sunny spells and scattered showers, heaviest across northern England, North Wales, North Midlands, East Anglia and Lincolnshire, where there could be the odd rumble of thunder. So not as warm as it has been, but still a little bit above par. At 20 to 25 degrees Celsius north to south. Northern Ireland and Scotland, however, will have more lengthy spells of showery rain. So the showers really becoming more frequent and long-lasting, intense. Could be some localised flooding from thunderstorms as we go through into the afternoon. Temperatures 16 to 19 degrees. Some rain for the far north of Scotland too.
And thank you for that. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb.
Good morning, if you're just joining us or if you're still with us, it's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 19th of August. The headlines for you. UK inflation has jumped to its highest rate since March, driven by a sharp increase in energy prices. Ukraine's ousted defence minister has delivered a blistering assessment of the government in Kyiv under President Zelensky, calling for a wartime election. And the Queen has spoken of her struggle to keep the King's cancer diagnosis a secret before it was revealed to the world.
Coming up in the next hour, a drive to offer every rough sleeper in England a bed this winter has been announced by Andy Burnham. The Housing Secretary, Angela Rayner, will join us in the next half hour. Applications for degree apprenticeships are soaring as students look for alternatives to university debt, but many apparently finding it hard to find spaces.
I was logging how much time I was spending throughout the kind of 7-8 months that I was doing this application process, and I think it was just under about 500 hours.
Hello from Mike Williams, live at Headingley this morning, where the Yorkshire sun is shining on a new dawn for English cricket. Joe Root is back as test captain at the start of a 3-match series against Pakistan. But how much will this side miss Ben Stokes?
It does change the balance to things to a degree. You lose your captain, a batter and a bowler all in one. But it gives an opportunity for us to look at something slightly different, to reshape the team.
The BBC News read this morning by Jane Steele.
UK inflation rose last month to 2.9%, largely driven by higher energy prices, according to the Office for National Statistics. That's up from 2.6% in June. The Chancellor, John Healey, said the war in the Middle East was continuing to affect prices at home, but the British economy was resilient. The Conservatives said Labour had left the country unprepared for global shocks. Here's our Deputy Economics Editor, Darshini David.
The initial surge in gas prices prompted by the war in Iran turned up the heat on inflation last month, thanks to a rise in the domestic energy bill price cap. But at 2.9%, inflation remains more modest than some analysts feared at the start of the war, especially as the impact of higher energy costs hasn't materialised in items such as food and drink. Inflation there at 1.3% is at its lowest for close to 5 years. Those cost pressures may yet appear in coming months as they're passed through supply chains, and economists expect inflation to hit 3.5% later in the year. That would still be a fraction of the inflation seen at the start of the war in Ukraine. But if the conflict in the Middle East drags on, the inflation rate risks creeping higher.
Ukraine's former defence minister, Mykhailo Fedorov, whose sacking last month prompted mass protests, has called for elections. In a video posted online, Mr. Fedorov said Ukraine was facing a crisis of governance and corruption. He's the first senior Ukrainian politician to demand new elections, which are prohibited by law during wartime. From Kyiv, here's our Ukraine correspondent, Dan Johnson.
Mykhailo Fedorov didn't name President Zelensky in his video statement, but it was a blistering assessment of Ukraine's government under his leadership, with a call for a major clean-up and changes to the way the state, and therefore the war, is run. The 35-year-old sacked defence minister said democracy was not a peacetime luxury.
Democracy cannot be held hostage by Russia. We are fighting precisely because we want to remain a free European state. That is why we must find a legal, safe and realistic mechanism that will allow Ukraine to restore a full democratic process, even during a prolonged war.
Ukrainian law prevents elections during conflict, but Mr. Fedorov said trust between citizens and state had to be rebuilt and hope restored. He said corruption was depriving the military of weapons and equipment and making it harder for Ukraine to win. There have been weekly protests in support of the former minister, who's seen as a modernising figure who transformed the battlefield with drone warfare, but who disagreed with the head of the armed forces. He didn't rule out running in any election, and recent polls indicate he would beat President Zelensky.
There's been no immediate reaction from President Zelensky's office to the comments by Mykhailo Fedorov, but Oleksandr Mrejko, who's an MP from Mr. Zelensky's Servant of the People Party and chairs Ukraine's Foreign Affairs Committee, told us that holding wartime elections would be very damaging.
Most importantly, politically, it's very dangerous because Putin will definitely use this as a moment of kind of division, political infighting, and he will use it in his favor. So the thing is that holding elections right now, it might just bury the country.
In the past few minutes, the governor of Kherson has said four people have been killed by a Russian drone attack on a bus. Four others were wounded. The Prime Minister has vowed that every rough sleeper in England will be offered accommodation this winter. Andy Burnham made ending rough sleeping his first pledge on entering Downing Street and says he now wants to get everyone in for Christmas. In an article for The Guardian, he said boosting economic growth would mean nothing if people were still sleeping rough under the cranes building that new Britain. Our social affairs correspondent Michael Buchanan reports.
According to official data, almost 4,800 people were rough sleeping in England in a single night last autumn, a figure that's almost doubled since 2021, when a pandemic-era programme to protect rough sleepers from COVID-19 saw significant reductions. Andy Burnham says he hopes to build on the success of that scheme and has pledged a total of £442 million to tackle a problem he says that Westminster has started to accept. Councils and mayors will be asked to find local solutions, such as sourcing temporary accommodation in night shelters, B&Bs, flats and houses. The money will also be used to find more than 1,000 houses over the next 3 years to move rough sleepers into permanent accommodation. Homeless charities have welcomed the initiative, but the Conservatives say the Prime Minister's pledge didn't have any plan for delivery.
Police in West Sussex say three members of the same family died after getting into difficulty in the water off Shoreham-by-Sea yesterday. Four people were brought to shore after an extensive rescue operation, but officers later said a man, a woman and a teenage girl had died and a younger girl from the same family was in a critical condition in hospital. Chief Superintendent James Collis from Sussex Police said inquiries were continuing to understand what happened.
I know this incident will have had a profound effect on the community and inquiries are ongoing alongside our partners to understand the full details. At this point, we believe all four entered the water from the land for a swim and sadly got into difficulty.
The BBC has found that competition for degree apprenticeships advertised on the government's platform in England has quadrupled in the past 3 years. The popularity of degree apprenticeships, which offer a paid-for university degree and a salary, has grown as the cost of university has come under increased scrutiny. More from our education correspondent, Hazel Shearing.
There are more than 11 applications for every degree apprenticeship on the government's Find an Apprenticeship service in England. The data is an indication of soaring demand, with the number of applicants more than doubling and the number of positions almost halving in the past 3 years. Concerns about the cost of university has prompted more students to live at home, and there are calls to reform student loan repayments. The Department for Work and Pensions says it's backing employers who take on young apprentices.
An Australian woman who killed three relatives by feeding them a meal containing poisonous mushrooms has begun an appeal against her murder conviction. Erin Patterson was sentenced to life in prison in September for triple murder with a minimum term of 33 years. Her lawyers say she didn't receive a fair trial last year. The prosecution is also appealing against the sentence, arguing she should never be freed. Here's our Australia correspondent Katie Watson.
Erin Patterson joined today's hearing on video link from prison, but Ian Wilkinson, the sole survivor from a lunch in which Patterson fed members of her family beef Wellington cooked with death cap mushrooms, was in court. Patterson's team has listed seven grounds for appeal, beginning by arguing that the trial had been compromised after jurors were put in a hotel during deliberations, where prosecutors, a key witness and media also happened to be staying. Then they moved on to mobile phone data evidence and internet sightings of death caps, which they say shouldn't have been included, as there was no proof Erin Patterson had seen those mushrooms online. Tomorrow, the prosecution will outline why they believe she should never be released from prison.
The Queen has described the pressure of keeping the King's cancer diagnosis secret in the early stages of his treatment. She was speaking in a video released by Buckingham Palace to mark the 30th anniversary of the cancer charity Maggie's, of which she's the president. Our senior royal correspondent Daniela Ralph reports.
In the video, Queen Camilla talks about officially opening a Maggie's Cancer Support Centre in London in January 2024, when she knew her husband, the King, had just been diagnosed with cancer. The news hadn't been made public, and as the Queen spoke to staff, patients and their families, she had to keep the information to herself. Describing the moment as difficult, the Queen recalled almost mentioning the challenges her family were facing, but felt it wasn't the time.
That was quite difficult. I almost said something, but you know, I felt that it wasn't the time to say. Looked at everybody who was suffering and all the relations, and I think it made me realise even more how important these places were. I was just longing to let it out, but obviously I couldn't.
More than 2 years after his diagnosis, the King is continuing his treatment. Buckingham Palace has reiterated that his health is moving in a very positive direction. Maggie's is one of several cancer charities that have praised the King for being open about his illness.
The Met Office is asking the public to choose which of the stars of the children's animation series Timmy Time or Shaun the Sheep should have a future storm named after them. The forecaster hopes the collaboration with the animation studio Aardman will encourage the public to take notice when severe weather is approaching.
Thank you for that. 8:10 is the time. We heard mention of it in the news, but it was not exactly a headline. A Russian drone attack on a bus in Ukraine's southern city of Kherson killed four people early this morning. A bus carrying civilians, which a drone operator would have seen, was carrying civilians. One of the features of modern war is the use of drones. They can target small groups of people, even individuals. In Ukraine, they are often used by Russia to kill civilians deliberately to foster terror and sap morale. On the 4th of August, Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, shared a video on social media. You may remember this. It was a drone hunting down a man in the city in the Kherson region. President Zelensky said it showed an instance of a Russian safari attack against civilians. The video actually shows the drone pursuing a street vendor on a city street in Kherson. The man moves away from the drone, it hovers, it chases him, and then, as you heard there, it swoops down and explodes on impact. The man actually escaped with shrapnel wounds, concussion and trauma, but he did manage to keep his life. Sometimes called human safari, the deployment of remotely operated drones against civilians has often been used by Russians to terrify residents of frontline areas. Olga is a woman who lives in Kherson and has spoken to us about life constantly trying to keep safe from those drones. She also described how drone warfare has made life in the city more difficult.
It has become really harder here in Kherson. I survived the different periods. But I think that now the fear appears just to go to leave the house. It has changed dramatically, I would say, because the drones are always flying over Kherson. Every other minute, they are flying in different parts of the city. People survive. It's the only word which I can say. It's not life. It's the fight with your fears, the fight for your life every other minute.
Well, the UN Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs, Tom Fletcher, wants to draw the world's attention to the harm being done by drones. He has gone himself to the regions of Ukraine worst affected. I've been talking to him about what he's seen.
So I've been in Ukraine, it's my third day now. We're heading back to Kherson again this morning, and we'll once again drive down what they call, the Ukrainians call the road of death. You're just a few kilometres from the front lines. Yesterday in a hospital, I was just a kilometre away from the front lines. And you're seeing the reality of people living every day with these the saturation of drone attacks on this area. As you drive along that road, you know, listeners of a certain age will remember Mad Max, but you've got this netting across the road to try and keep the drones out. And, you know, they've had 5,500 attacks a week, drone attacks a week there. And everyone I talk to knows the language of drones. They know the difference between the sound of a Shahed drone and a drone piloted by optical fibers. They know what a first-person view drone can do compared to the what they call the loitering munitions that are hanging around waiting for a chance to attack. And it's chilling, this alliance between sort of deadly technology and warfare. You know, buildings we were in yesterday got hit by drones while we were in meetings. And it's you can see why there's that level of collective anxiety among the population.
And it is a deliberate attempt to target the population, isn't it? These are not military targets.
So I visited a hospital yesterday that had been hit and met, you know, two people, a fruit seller and somebody had been in a shop. The fruit seller had been, you know, inches from death. The guy had been shopping, had his legs completely amputated as a result of the attack. So it's hard to see how these are military targets. They're also, as you drive down that road into Kherson, the road of death, you see the bombed out petrol stations, gas stations. And there have been many attacks across the country on civilian infrastructure, on water and electricity.
The outside world is aware of this. And we have reports from what you have seen as well, from the areas that you are in. To what extent is the outside world hampered by a lack of resources, a lack of the ability to assist?
Well, of course, you know, we're facing lack of resources. We face massive cuts across the humanitarian mission. And, you know, in the last 3 years, today's World Humanitarian Day, we've lost over 1,000 colleagues in not just Ukraine, but across Sudan, Gaza, Lebanon, South Sudan, Somalia, Yemen, so many of the places that we're working. So we are hampered. But, you know, I'm particularly worried, having been here these last few days, about this new technology, about the way that drones are being used against civilians. Just in the last few weeks, I was in Somalia, South Sudan, and women told me that they were fleeing not conflict, not hunger, but these very cheap drones being used against them. Yesterday, the drone attack that I was visiting was caused by a $300 first-person view drone. You know, it's you know, these are kids piloting these things like they're gaming. And then I think the technology, I'm afraid, is outpacing accountability, and the technology is outpacing humanity. And I really worry that when these new weapons are being designed, there aren't enough people in the room who understand protection of civilians, protection of humanitarians, and ultimately who understand international humanitarian law.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And it's a discussion we had on the programme recently when it comes to targeting and whether there could one day be accountability. And we heard a view that there might one day be accountability. But of course, in a sense, that just doesn't help now, because it doesn't help those people who are currently being targeted.
That's right. And they don't have much hope in accountability. And to be honest, you know, and it's a depressing thought for me. I've been in this job almost 2 years, and I've lost over 500 colleagues in that time. I'm not sure there'll be accountability for any of those deaths. And we call for investigations. And obviously, you know, it frustrates people when I come on and do media and they say, well, who did it to you? And I'm saying, look, we're like the ambulance service or the fire service. We're trying to help the survivors of these attacks. We're not then the investigators to try and bring the attackers to account. But, you know, we're more frustrated. We're more angry than anyone.
The Ukrainians are not deliberately targeting civilians, but they are using drones, aren't they? And they're using drones in a way in which civilians can be injured, particularly when they're targeting these centres of distribution for parcels, etc. Are you worried as well about what Ukraine is doing, indeed doing with Western help, indeed British help?
So drones are such a massive part of warfare now. Here across those front lines. So both the Russians and Ukrainians using increasingly sophisticated drones. And, you know, the worry in a way with these weapons is we were always told that these are precision weapons. They're targeted weapons. So they should be, you know, they should be good news for civilians. But that's just not what we're experiencing, whether they're being used by the parties of the war here or being used in Sudan, in Gaza, in Lebanon, South Sudan, Somalia, Yemen. Everywhere we're seeing the risk to civilians. And the more it seems that you have AI involved in these weapon systems, the less guarantee there is that there will be those civilian protections in place. So the problem here is the rules just aren't keeping up with the technology. And you've got this deadly alliance, chilling alliance, really, between the greatest technological brains on the planet and people who want to kill a scale.
What do we do about it?
So, you know, at the moment, you know, I've got a big focus here on how do we protect our humanitarians better? How do we protect civilians better? So we're looking at, can we use scanners more effectively? You know, the kinds of body armor, the armored vehicles and so on that we need for our humanitarians. But that's sticking plaster. We shouldn't have to do that. You know, we humanitarians, we shouldn't have to know the difference between a Shahed drone and a first-person view drone. Beyond that, in terms of protecting civilians, we need member states, and we need the international community to stand up and genuinely demand accountability, the investigations into those killing civilians. We need the rules of law to keep up with the new technology of war, and that's just not happening. And, you know, I'd add, I would like a lot more attention on the companies designing, supplying these drones as well. It's not just about the kid firing this piece of lethal kit. I'd like to see that whole chain about where the parts are coming from. And have we got enough of a grip on what we know these weapons are then being used to do?
You mentioned Gaza. Can I ask you about Gaza? UNICEF have put out a report that rates of malnutrition there are actually quite substantially lower than in some neighbouring places. Was that a surprise to you, given all that has been said about Gaza in recent months?
No, not a surprise, because, I mean, we're almost a year now into delivering that Sharm el-Sheikh agreement, the 20-point plan, and particularly on food, we've made real progress in that time. We're getting almost a million hot meals out in Gaza every day. So we've got those malnutrition rates down from the very high levels of hunger and starvation that we saw just over a year ago. The big challenge now, actually, is getting more crossings open so we can get more shelter equipment in, more health in to the population of Gaza, who are still living in miserable, grim conditions.
Would you like to see more attention given to places where obviously there is very acute malnutrition at the moment. So the figure for Gaza is 1.3% suffering acute malnutrition. Again, this is according to UNICEF. But in Syria, 12.2%, 17.7% in Sudan, where you've been relatively recently. Is there enough attention given to those places?
Well, certainly by us. I was in, as you say, in those several of those countries recently. I'm very worried about malnutrition rates in Yemen right now across the DRC. So we're on this, and we adjust our response to where the levels are highest, to where the malnutrition levels, the starvation, the risk of famine is highest. What we call severity 4 and 5. And so we're focused on reaching the 87 million people globally who right now most need our help.
Tom Fletcher, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you, Justin.
21 minutes past 8. To return our attention to what's happening in this country, the Prime Minister has vowed every rough sleeper, well, certainly in England, I should say, is to be offered accommodation this winter. Andy Burnham made ending rough sleeping his first pledge on entering Downing Street, and now a total of £442 million has been pledged to make that promise a reality. But having promised and failed to end rough sleeping in Greater Manchester during his time as mayor, with the numbers of those sleeping on the streets in the area going up in recent years, not down, what will be different? The Prime Minister is hoping the spirit of the pandemic can prevail once again and empowering local areas. Is it the best use of money? Angela Rayner is the Housing, Communities and Local Government Secretary, talking to us this morning from Newcastle. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can I ask, first of all, just to be clear, what does it mean, is it in time for Christmas, and is it taken off, those people taken off the streets for good?
Well, what we're doing is this £442 million will be available working with local partners and charities to start the process for this winter to give people the opportunity to get off the streets, and then put in a support package around people as well, like we've seen with the Housing First model, and making sure our partners in health and in other parts of government are tackling some of the long-term issues that mean that people remain rough sleeping. And you referenced Greater Manchester. When the mayor originally started Bed for a Night, we saw the numbers go down significantly, like we did during the pandemic nationally. The challenge is we haven't had a national programme, and that's why numbers have been increasing. So we want to tackle this in the short term for this winter, but we're also investing more money now into making sure that we can get people the homes they need through the £39 billion of investment over the next decade to build the social housing that the country desperately needs, because we have a supply problem there's too many people on housing waiting lists.
We'll sort of come to that. So just in answer to when Prime Minister Burnham will end rough sleeping, when is that?
Well, like I say, what we're doing is we're making sure that by this winter there will be an offer, that people will have an opportunity to be off the streets, and that we want to end homelessness. That means you have to have a relentless drive, and we've seen it where
governments but homelessness and rough sleeping are different things in the sense of, and also how you have to tackle them, and waiting lists, and we'll get to that in a moment. But I'm just trying to understand, is there a deadline for you're making an offer, you say, by this winter, so nobody will be sleeping rough on the streets, you hope, this winter and over Christmas? That's what the hope is. But what is the goal of this government? To do it by the end of the term, at the end of next year? What have you been communicated to?
Well, there will be an offer for all rough sleepers, but the challenge, and I suppose you alluded to it in your segment on what happened in Greater Manchester and what we saw in the pandemic, is you can't just do it as a one-off. You have to continually look at that. So the investment that we're putting in, alongside the supply side challenges that we're engaging with to resolve those supply issues, means that we will have more houses available, and we'll have that support that's ongoing. Because if you take your foot off the gas, then we see those numbers rising again. So we've made a number of changes.
Did he take his foot off the gas in Manchester?
No, but
that was implied by a journalist who said it was politically the focus. And actually, the context is completely different to the pandemic in so many ways, of course. But hotel use, during the pandemic, there were no visitors in hotels, so there were spaces. Do we have the homes this Christmas to put people in?
So what happened in Greater Manchester, and as you know, I'm a Greater Manchester MP, so I represent Tameside, is we have excellent facilities that we've been working with local charities, with the local authorities, to make sure that there are numerous different options available, whether that's self-contained flats, supported lodgings, etc. But what we saw is because of it was focused on Greater Manchester, the numbers went down significantly there, but then we didn't have a national programme, so everybody knew that Greater Manchester was the place where you got the support. And what we need to do is make sure that that offer is available so that we can ensure that it, regardless of where you are in England, that there is an offer to support people. Now, I can't guarantee that everybody is going to at that moment say that is the right choice for me. But what you have to do is relentlessly carry on focusing on it to support people. And some people might need second or third opportunities because they're not ready yet. There may be other challenges. Often there is a mental health crisis or challenges with addiction. So joining up with our health service and other colleagues and other departments so that not only are we saying to someone there's an offer that you don't have to be sleeping rough, but that we're going to work with them individually on some of the challenges they face to get them on the right track. And we know that Housing First is also critically part of that programme and that we're working to ensure that there is those opportunities for people to get long-term secure housing.
In the detail, though, and what was criticised in Manchester, for instance, is the bed every night scheme was criticised because it allowed, for instance, single men to jump the queue for housing ahead of a woman perhaps with a few children who was stuck in a B&B.
Well, no, because we've been doing a huge amount of work. And in fact, in my area in Tameside, again, we were one of the pilots because we had a number of families in temporary accommodation around tackling the challenge of supply, which is why the Prime Minister said we need to build the council housing. Now, what we've done on that is we've
but
given
councils...
But that's
going to take a long time, isn't it, to get to the level that you've promised already under the previous Prime Minister?
Exactly, but within the first couple of months of entering government, we started the consultation on the National Planning Policy Framework. You'll have seen the announcement just this week that means that we will make it easier for planning around transport, etc., so that we can get the homes built. We brought in mandatory local plans that councils...
But you're not letting me finish to give you the changes
that are starting to have an effect because we've seen 15% increase in the number of home starts. Councils have built the most council housing than they have done since the early 90s last year. So the planning reforms we've already made, we've got the Planning Act that has now come into law, the changes to the MPPF, the £39 billion of investment over the next 10 years, and giving councils more freedoms and more resources for them to build the homes we need. We are starting to see the green shoots of that.
But that does take time. But how many council houses did you build last year?
Well, we've been building the council houses. We need to get them up to a higher level. I think it was around 11,000, maybe just under 12,000 council houses that were built last year. But we know we need to do more, but we're seeing them go up.
I know it takes time, but it's just trying to marry this pledge with the reality of what's available and also whether people think this is the right use of money. Because, I mean, in your press release, your announcement this morning, you've quoted a figure, or rather the government has, from the charity crisis suggesting preventing 40,000 people from becoming homeless for a year could save taxpayers £370 million. If you're going to clarify that, the £442 million isn't designed to prevent homelessness. It's designed to end rough sleeping. There are currently 4,667 rough sleepers at a count last year in England. I mean, if you do some maths on that, I know it's not perfect, but it's around £95,000 per rough sleeper. Is that the right use of this money for people who are thinking, what about adult and child social care, for instance?
Well, we've got over 175,000 children currently in temporary accommodation. We're putting a record £4 billion into homelessness. So we've been tackling temporary accommodation. We've put £39 billion into the Affordable and Social Homes Programme over the next decade. We've changed planning rules so that we can build the homes and, crucially, the infrastructure that people desperately need. This has been been a crisis, a housing crisis that has been building up under the previous government, and we've started to tackle it, including ending no-fault evictions, Section 21, which the previous government promised they'd do. They didn't. I've done that to make sure that these that we're stopping people from being made homeless. We've got the Renters' Rights Act that allows people in private accommodation to get more support and more rights so that they can't be evicted or that they get rent hikes that they can't afford. So we're tackling the issues that are really driving this crisis we face. But you're absolutely right to say that supply is the challenge, and it's why we're putting that record investment in.
Just to take our attention to what underpins it all, the economy, and you're looking at the inflation figure today. I mean, of course, you would not expect anything else, but the Conservatives are saying its prices are accelerating once again under your government. You know, they left inflation bang on the 2% target. Now it's been above that level for 22 months in a row. That's what the Shadow Chancellor has been saying. But in terms of also just looking at, you know, wages, new figures show wage growth in the private sector has fallen to a six-year low, while pay in the public sector has risen sharply. Is that something to celebrate?
Well, obviously, we've been tackling the cost of living, and we've seen that the situation now with the Iran war is having an impact on prices here at home. It's why we kept the UK out of the conflict in the Middle East in the first place. Our first act under the new Prime Minister was to cut VAT on electricity bills and to cap bus fares at £2, because we're trying to give people the breathing space. And the economy is showing signs of resilience. We're the fastest growing economy in the G7. In the first half of this year, but they are the international headwinds that are challenging. But we are saying that there's more that we can do, and we are doing, to try and give people the breathing space and acknowledge that the cost of living at the moment, the everyday essentials that people need, have increased. And that's why we've taken action on VAT on electricity bills, capping bus fares, 20% off business rates for pubs, clubs and music venues next year.
On the question of private sector versus the public sector, are you concerned about public sector going up and private sector going down in terms of wages?
Well, again, we've seen the wages compared to the cost of living, people have got less money, take home money, whether you're in the private or public sector.
No, but it's an indicator. It's an indicator, isn't it, of what's going on with it, with industry, with business, and the health of the economy. I'm just trying to get, and it's also perhaps, you know, to talk about productivity. I mean, there was a report last week, I'm sure you saw it in the Times newspaper. 71 staff, talking about the public sector, in your department haven't been recorded as visiting the offices for over a year. Do you think that's acceptable?
Well, I think that, you know, I'm not a Jacob Rees-Mogg that I have to see someone in the office to know that they're working. You know, I've worked, I wasn't office-based for many years, actually, in the job that I do. And I think people work extremely hard. I don't think this is a productivity problem because individuals are in or outside the office.
But what is it then? Because public sector productivity still lies below pre-pandemic levels.
I think the challenge that we face actually is that the cost of things have gone up and wages haven't gone up in the same rate as the cost of living of essential items, which is why the Prime Minister has been clear that we need to tackle the cost of living crisis and make everyday items that people need are resolved.
It was a question also, I suppose, about productivity and work ethic, as well as the price and those sides of things. But so you're not concerned about people not coming to the office in your department?
Well, I don't see people as being physically in the office all the time as an issue around productivity. I've actually seen when there's been studies done that actually people that work from home where they can, productivity can go up. I think it's
It might be the false flag. So if you look at
If you look at some of the studies where people have done home working, actually within their department, sickness levels have gone down, that productivity has gone up. So I dispute that the productivity issue in our country is because somebody works from an office or somebody works from home. I don't think that is the case.
We'll have to talk again, Angela, I'm out of time, about what what is the reason. Angela Rayner, cliffhanger there, Housing, Communities and Local Government Secretary in Newcastle this morning. Good morning. Thank you.
Just to tell you, coming up soon, an interview with the new England cricket captain, Joe Root. But first, a word from Matthew Syme.
Have you ever shared something unexpectedly personal with a complete stranger? This morning on Sideways, I hear how the kindness of strangers in the online and real world has been at the heart of Ben West's story following the tragic loss of his brother to suicide. Today, Ben is a remarkable mental health campaigner whose work recognises the power in all of us to help people we've never met. Join me, Matthew Syme, for Sideways this morning at 9 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
At 24 minutes to 9, you are listening to Today. Much more to come on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett. And now, a summary of the news with Jane Steele.
Figures from the Office for National Statistics show that UK inflation rose to 2.9% in the 12 months to July, up from 2.6% in the year to June. The change was mostly driven by the increase in the regulator Ofgem's energy price cap last month. Ukraine's former defence minister, Mikhailo Fedorov, has called for wartime elections to be held, saying the country was facing a crisis of governance. His sacking by President Zelensky last month sparked nationwide protests. Four people have been killed in a drone attack on a bus in Kherson in southern Ukraine. The United Nations aid chief, Tom Fletcher, told this programme the city was seeing thousands of drone attacks every week, with civilians saying they were being targeted. Moscow denies targeting civilians. Andy Burnham has promised to offer all rough sleepers in England a bed this winter as part of a £440 million package. Ending rough sleeping was the first pledge made by Mr. Burnham when he became Prime Minister.
Thank you for that. Let us turn at 23 minutes to 9 to Mike with the sport, because Mike is at Headingley. Morning again, Mike.
Hello, Justin. Yes, welcome back to Headingley, where we are just over a couple of hours away from the start of the first test between England and Pakistan. We are just looking out over the outfield here at the moment. The covers are off, I can tell you. The practice nets are up, and thankfully the sun is out. We did have a bit of overnight rain here in Leeds, but we now have clearing blue skies in Yorkshire, and we are watching the ground staff busily tend to the pitch in front of us. Now, England, as we've been saying all morning, have gone back to the future for this match, with Joe Root returning as Test captain for a second time. England's most experienced player, their highest ever run scorer, will lead the team once again, having stood down as skipper in 2022 after a five-year stint. He was replaced by Ben Stokes, of course, who retired from Test cricket last month. So it is deja vu all over again for Root. And I caught up with him yesterday at Headingley and asked him, 4 years on, how it feels to be preparing to captain your country once more.
Very excited, very much looking forward to it. It feels very different. I'll be honest, it's a very different set of circumstances, very different group of players to last time round, and I feel like a very different player. So obviously you've got the experience of knowing what to expect in some ways, but the excitement of it being very different in the same respect too.
How long did you have to think about it after you were asked to return to the captaincy?
I had a little while thinking about it and making sure that it felt like it was the right thing for me. But once I spoke to Stephen Fleming and understood how he saw the game and his vision for this team, you know, very quickly got very excited about things and, you know, was very much looking forward to taking on the challenge of it.
Did you speak to Ben Stokes before making your mind up?
Yeah, I speak to Ben quite frequently and, you know, spoke to him on a couple of occasions. So we spoke about different things throughout and will continue to. You know, we're good friends away from the game and don't see that changing at all.
Presumably he gave you his full blessing to take up this role. How big a hole does his absence, though, leave in this England side?
Yeah, I mean, it does change the balance to things to a degree. You lose your captain, a batter and a bowler all in one. So, but it gives an opportunity for us to look at something slightly different, to reshape the team in a slightly different way and to look at attacking opposition in a slightly different way. And I think with that comes great opportunity for those guys that have that chance. So it might not be, you know, how we've traditionally structured things for a long period of time, with Ben being ever present for the best part of 15 years, but you know, I don't think that's necessarily has to be to our detriment in some ways. It can be an opportunity for us to look at the game slightly differently and find a way of getting more out of players in slightly different roles.
Not many captains, Joe, across any sport return for a second stint with the armband. Was there a bit of a sense of duty here, a sense of answering an SOS call from your country in its hour of need?
No, is the honest answer. I feel like once I spoke to Stephen Fleming and saw how he saw the game, saw that we were very aligned on a number of things and how excited I was about where he thought we could take this team, it made it quite a different proposition to what it was if I'd have been asked about it 2 years ago. And, you know, after my previous experience and how that sort of came to an end. So the world's very different now. You know, we're not living in COVID bubbles and spending long periods of time not seeing loved ones and family and stuff like that. It's a very different team. It's a very exciting young team with huge amounts of talent and potential. And I'm really looking forward to trying to let that flourish and bring that the best out of those guys and hopefully evolve this team from, you know, a lot of the good work that happened under Brendan and Ben. The foundations of what they've done and achieved over that 4 year were amazing. The recent results obviously have not been what we wanted, but if we can tweak and evolve things slightly, then I really feel that we can see a massive upside in that side of things and take this team to some really special places.
I appreciate he's not in post yet for this series with Pakistan, but it is fair to say, is it, that the appointment of new head coach Stephen Fleming was very influential in your decision to return as captain?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been in constant conversation since and just prior, and obviously hugely impressive him firstly as a player, and then clearly what he's achieved throughout his coaching career, albeit a lot of it in franchise cricket. His experience captain in New Zealand for such a long period of time, playing 100 test matches, he's just a very impressive man. I think holds the room amazingly well when he speaks, and has some very interesting ideas about where he can take this team. So very much looking forward to him getting here and working with him and staying in constant comms with him throughout the next little while too.
Let's just end on Pakistan, the opponents for the next three tests. On paper, I'm guessing them will be favourites for this series, but you only have to look a few days ago, don't you, to what happened in Darwin, Bangladesh beating Australia in Australia, to show that you can never be complacent.
No, and Pakistan have the ability and some wonderful players within that team. A lot of experienced guys that have spent a lot of time playing county cricket that understand the conditions and what it takes to get success here in England. So they're a formidable team, and we're going to have to play some really strong cricket. But to start here at Headingley, a ground where we all enjoy playing, we've had success here, I think makes for brilliant test match cricket as well. I think it's the best surface in the country for the format. If we can manage those conditions well and have good answers to the questions that are asked of us from Pakistan, you know, we'll be in a good place at the end of the week.
Well, all the best for this match, this series and beyond, Joe Root. Many thanks for speaking to us on the programme.
Thank you for having me. Cheers.
Well, Joe Root scored a century in his first match as England captain in 2017. Could he do the same at the start of his second stint as skipper here at his home ground of Headingley? We shall see. You can, of course, follow the first test between England and Pakistan on Test Match Special, which is on air this morning on BBC Sounds from 10:25.
Mike, enjoy. Thank you so much. It's 17 minutes to nine. Let's talk about something completely different in the sense of safety this summer and the water and our knowledge of it. Because three members of the same family, a man, a woman and a teenage girl, have died after getting into difficulty in the water offshore and by sea. A younger girl from the same family was in hospital in a critical condition. James Collis is Chief Superintendent at Sussex Police.
Despite the best efforts of paramedics, three people, a man, a woman and a teenage girl, were sadly confirmed deceased. A younger girl has been taken to hospital and is in critical condition. We can confirm all four people were from the same family.
It's the latest in a series of deaths this summer. There are estimates that 19 people drowned across the country over the May half term alone, and questions are being asked about whether we are taking water safety seriously enough. Ashley Jones is Head of Water Safety and Education at the Royal Life Saving Society. Ashley, what do you want to see change after this summer and what happened in May alone?
Morning, Emma. I think, first of all, it's really important for us to give our condolences to the friends and family of those that have lost their lives, not just in the most recent incident, but in all of the high number of tragic incidents that we've seen across the summer. There are a number of things that we can do. Unfortunately, drowning isn't a simple issue, but we would really like to see it treated as the public health issue that it is. At the minute, it's too often seen as a tragic accident that wasn't preventable, and that just isn't the case. It is a preventable public health issue. And to that end, we'd really like government to step up to the mark and treat it that way. So first of all, a minister with responsibility for water safety and drowning prevention would be the first place that we'd like to start.
So a new national strategy was launched last month by Water Safety England. That was to introduce widespread swimming lessons and enhanced water safety education. There's also a campaign in The Mirror, which Andy Burnham has backed, I'm sure you'll be aware of, Save Lives for Sam. That's named in honour of 16-year-old Sam Haycock, who drowned in a reservoir in 2021. What more in terms of public education do you think there should be?
So at the minute, we are in the position where water safety will be part of the RSE curriculum in England from September, but that forms just a very small part. Water safety is one line of 42 on that national curriculum. That means a young person might get one lesson every 3 years that talks about the hazards. Swimming is part of the national curriculum at Key Stage 2, so that's the end of primary school. What that leaves us is a huge gap in creating a population that are able to go out and enjoy the water safely. So we'd really like to see more swimming in Key Stage 3 and 4, and we'd really like to see the importance of water safety education elevated. So it's not just a half an hour that's delivered once.
Ashley Jones, Head of Water Safety and Education at the Royal Life Saving Society. Thank you.
And that brings us to 13 minutes to nine. We need cheaper electricity and we need it now, say the Conservatives this morning. They're promising to tell us the costs of the net zero policy being pursued by the government. And they say they have a better plan. And Andrew Bowie is the Conservative Member of Parliament for West Aberdeenshire and Kirkcaldin. He also is Shadow Minister for Energy Security and Net Zero, and indeed Shadow Secretary of State for Scotland, and is on the line. Morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
That's quite a lot of shadow posts. Yeah. Well done. You'll be busy and using a lot of energy, no doubt.
Yeah, quite.
But what is the point you're making this morning specifically about electricity?
Well, the point is, Justin, that we all want to see this cleaner future. But the way that the Labour Party are going around delivering that is wrong and costing British consumers, costing British business far too much. The proposal that's being set out today by Onward in this report that we are endorsing says that we can reach that cleaner future, get more electrification, but do it cheaper by looking towards gas, nuclear, and where it's affordable, yes, some renewables. This desire to have a wholly renewable grid, clean power 2030, net zero 2050, is entirely the wrong approach. It's prohibitively expensive. It's leading to deindustrialization and the hidden costs that are associated with it, which this government is paying no regard to whatsoever, be that the new grid infrastructure that needs to be built from the Scottish Highlands down to the southeast of England to deliver that new wind power to where it's required, or indeed the constraint payments, which were roughly £2 billion last year to turn off wind farms when it's too windy, are just not being taken into account. We're looking at the cost of this drive towards net zero. So our way, our approach, as set out in this report today, is to do things better, cheaper, quicker, but of course, ultimately cleaner, which is what we all want to do.
Ultimately, though, with a reduced time frame or a more relaxed time frame.
Yeah, we're not going to be setting any arbitrary dates and targets. Kemi's been quite clear about that.
On that then, if you're not setting arbitrary dates, because we hear this again and again in this space, don't we? If you don't have an arbitrary date, then what happens, and you think of the car industry, what happens is people just drift and investment doesn't come because there isn't a date that everyone agrees on and looks to. Isn't that the risk with this?
Look, there are risks associated with a whole host of different approaches, but the fact is that the approach being taken right now by government, we've had this net zero 2050 date in legislation and law since 2019, and we've seen costs rise and rise year upon year. We promised the British people that a cleaner grid, a renewables-based grid, net zero 2050, would reduce bills for British consumers. What we've seen is bills go up year on year, and indeed energy becoming so expensive that deindustrialization industrialisation has been taking place in vast swathes of the country, be that in Fife and Grangemouth, in Potteries and Stoke, or indeed elsewhere, petrochemicals plants shutting down. And we need to arrest that decline. We cannot continue to be competitive. We need a strong economy. Andy Burnham and John Healy would agree with that. So let's look again at this approach towards developing that cleaner infrastructure, that cleaner grid that we need to get. Let's make it cheaper and let's deliver it in a quicker time. And I think that surely we can all agree that that's a sensible approach.
The other side of this, I suppose, is that there is a difference between not producing carbon emissions and not consuming them. In other words, it is perfectly possible not to produce them, but still to consume them in very large amounts if you import stuff that has been produced elsewhere.
Well, exactly. What we've seen over the past few years is the wholesale offshoring of British emissions. You know, we're still using the same, for example, number of bricks in construction in the UK, but fewer bricks are being built, made here in the UK because of the high cost of energy that it takes to produce them. But their bricks are still being made. We're importing them into the UK and we're still building with them, but the carbon emissions associated with producing that brick are not being accounted for in the UK. So it's, you know, it's a con being played on the British people on a massive scale that we say, you know, go around the world, we've reduced our emissions by X amount, when actually those emissions are still being pumped into the atmosphere, just not on British shores. So we need to take a different approach, and that's what this Onward report is setting out today, and that's what the Conservative Party would seek to do if we were lucky enough to get back into government in the next few years.
And yet, we've had this wildfires, we've seen the impact of climate change recently, everyone is talking about it. Is there a risk, though, that you are seen now with this policy to be denying something that people will say is obvious and that there needs to be a kind of emergency response to?
Look, nobody denies that climate, or nobody serious anyway, denies that climate change exists, and nobody serious denies that we need to take action to resolve one of the biggest challenges facing us as a planet. But the course that the current Labour government have us on right now is doing nothing to arrest global emissions. It's making Britain uncompetitive. We're losing jobs, whereas this approach would lead to a cleaner grid. It would lead to more electrification quicker. Right. It would do it cheaper, and that actually would yield great benefits both economically and ecologically to the UK.
Andrew Berry, thank you.
Thank you.
8 minutes to nine. Competition for degree apprenticeships advertised on the government's platform in England has quadrupled in the past 3 years. The popularity of these things, which offer a paid-for university degree and a salary, has grown as the cost of university has come under increased scrutiny. Perhaps you know someone doing a degree apprenticeship or someone who would like to. Anna is 18, she's just got one, and she's spoken to the BBC about how difficult the process was.
I spent pretty much my whole summer between year 12 and year 13 just writing my CV and writing my cover letter and kind of adapting it to each of the companies that I wanted to send it to. I was logging how much time I was spending throughout the kind of 7-8 months that I was doing this application process, and I think it was just under about 500 hours.
Wow. Lily Broth was listening to that, business operations manager at Intellect, an engineering small to medium enterprise based in Middlesbrough. Apparently you have 3 degree apprentices on at the moment, is that right, Lily?
Yeah, good morning, Emma. Yes, morning. We do. We have currently 3 degree apprentices working for us at the company at the moment. And I can imagine it is frustrating for young people at the moment who are struggling to access those opportunities. I think the demand for degree apprenticeships, as you say, has massively increased. And unfortunately, the supply just isn't there at the moment because I think essentially businesses just don't feel supported to be able to deliver those apprenticeships.
What would encourage you to take more people on so it doesn't necessarily need to take 500 hours?
I think the real issue that we've seen in the other businesses within our sector who are also recruiting for that have seen is just sort of the lack of funding and support and the complication of the processes and the lack of communication. There's a whole host, I think, of sort of systemic problems that are preventing businesses from being able to provide that support, particularly small businesses who don't necessarily have the resources and the sort of funding behind them to be able to deliver meaningful apprenticeships. I think it's not just a case of being able to put bums on seats and just hand out these apprenticeships. You've got to make sure that they're of a high quality and that the apprenticeships that we are providing are meaningful for the young people that are going to be taking part in them.
And how does this compare to regular apprentices, you know, for those who aren't sure of the differences?
So it kind of all depends on the course, really. There's lots of different options and there's lots of different routes, but the degree apprenticeship typically is a part-time course that can span anywhere up to 6 years. So apprentices would be 1 day a week typically at university, and then the remaining four sat within the business, gaining that industry insight and experience, in comparison to, say, a level three apprenticeship, which is significantly shorter. It can be anywhere from 3 years to four, and that can sort of be in block 2 week sessions at college and on site. It just varies dependent on the course, really, but the length, I think, of time is certainly something that stands out.
And it seems like it's, when you do finally get one and you're in the right place, it's a positive thing.
Oh, absolutely. I think the viewpoint of degree apprenticeships has really changed, and sort of the stigmas associated with apprenticeships has really changed over the last few years, which is really positive. I think historically they were seen as sort of the second best option to university. And the narrative around that's really changing.
Yes. And as though, you know, you can see from the demand as well, degree apprenticeships being what they are, people are trying very hard for them. Lily Brothwood, thank you for your time.
Final thought at 3 minutes to nine. Charles Darwin, it turns out, who was right about all sorts of things, was also right about, of all things, tickling, or why we are ticklish, or how we're ticklish. Jilan Zhong is on the line, who's a PhD student at Netherlands Radboud University and is author of a new paper on ticklishness, if I can put it like that. Good morning to you.
Hi, good morning.
What have you discovered?
To put it shortly, we tested two major questions in the study. First, we want to understand if ticklishness is really, as we would thought, that is a very prevalent experience among ourselves, if it's shared between cultures. And second, we want to understand why there are specific body areas that are more ticklish than others. And one of the explanations that have been proposed in the past was from Charles Darwin, that he said that the reason that we are ticklish was because only some body areas we typically receive less touch compared to others. So in our study, we asked participants to report, to draw on a body map, the front and back body, where they experience ticklishness. And we also asked them to draw in their day-to-day life where they are touched either by their family or friend members or by their partners, if they have a partner in that case. And we compared the two maps together, the ticklishness and touch maps together, and we found that indeed there is a significant correlation between the two, indicating that the areas that are more ticklish are usually received less touch in our daily life.
Right. And did Darwin have a theory as to why it was then, whether there was a sort of evolutionary aspect to what it is, the body's warning you, I suppose, or something?
There was a theory about the protective function of ticklishness, but not by Darwin, by other scholars in the past. Darwin himself didn't specifically say why he thought that. He just presented it as he said, as his daily observation, and of course he didn't really have the, like, the statistical tool that we have nowadays to really assess that question. Where at the same time, Darwin also mentioned other things about ticklishness that he thought. He also thought that the reason that we experience the sensation itself, like why we laugh out loud, why we move around when experiencing it, is because there is a certain surprise element coming to it, meaning that we feel surprise and want to express very intensively against it.
And was he right in that? Is it surprise?